and I'll be serving as your online moderator coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. Today's seminar is part of the CEC Training for OSC series. There'll be a number of events hosted on the Kluwen website throughout this month and into the winter. Today's session will focus on pipeline emergencies and is scheduled to run from approximately 2 p.m. Eastern until 5 p.m. Eastern. We're going to wait just a moment or two to allow a few additional participants to hop on, but while we're waiting, I'm going to cover some basic housekeeping items and reminder instructions for those of you who might be new to our seminars. Once I pull those instruction slides up, I will start clicking through the material, but just before I do that, those of you who have joined us online, you guys should see a few screens up on the window in front of you. The upper left half of your screen does have a welcome message, just giving you a bit of background information about our broadcast, as well as a disclaimer that the purpose of today's presentation is to stimulate thought and discussion, and that nothing in today's webinar is intended to supersede or contravene federal statutes, regulations, or official EPA policies. And below that, you'll find a bit of biographical information about our two presenters, Earl Liverman and Jim Mullins. But they'd also like to know a little bit about you. So we do have two interactive poll questions. It looks like many of you have already voted. So in the lower left, if you haven't done so already, now is the time to go ahead and click on your response, asking in the lower left half how many years of experience you may have in the emergency response arena. And it looks like we have a nice distribution. About a third of the audience is brand new. About a quarter of you have about 3 to 10 years of experience. And then almost 36% of the audience has 10 or more years in the emergency response field. To the right of that, in terms of organizational backgrounds, it looks like about a quarter of the audience is an EPA regional representative. Another quarter is coming from state, local, or tribal organizations. We do have a number of other federal partners, about 3 or 4 of those. And then almost 40% of the audience is actually coming in from private sector. And we do have a few international participants. So thank you and welcome to those guests. Let's get through those very brief instruction items so we can kick off the technical portion for today's broadcast. If you haven't done so already, the instructions on joining us should have been emailed to you already. You should look for an email from ballant.gene@epa.gov. That email would have pointed you to something called the seminar homepage, where you can read more about the event as well as our instructors, provide feedback later on, download copies of the presentation materials. Most importantly, click a button that says Go to Seminar. When you click that button, it'll actually allow you to check yourself in online and bring you to our fully interactive Adobe Connect room that we'll be using for the live broadcast. You can watch and listen in real time right through a computer or mobile device as our speakers deliver their talks. If you have technical problems, though, you can download those slides and just follow along on the telephone line. But we do encourage you to join us for this fully interactive session to take part of some cool polls and quizzes that we'll be pulling up throughout the broadcast. Our audio will be delivered online for all participants by default. So if you're having problems with that online audio, check your local speaker or volume controls on your computer or mobile device. If that doesn't resolve the issue, please use the Q&A window in the lower right corner to request the toll-free call-in number, and I'll be happy to share that with anyone who needs it. Just know if you join us on the phone lines, we will have the lines muted, and we ask that you remain on that global mute. We will be taking breaks for designated Q&A periods with our presenters, but our participants are encouraged to type up their comments and questions at any time. You can simply use that Q&A window in the lower right corner to type them up, and then we'll cue them, and I'll start reading them out loud at the designated breaks for Q&A. We'll get through whatever we can in the time that we have allotted in our 3-hour session. Our entire broadcast will be recorded and archived on the Kluwen website. Usually takes us a few days to get those archives out, so keep your eyes peeled for an email from me with the link for that free replay. And if you want to take a look at the current archives, again, we have nearly 520 archive seminars available for download from the website. Remember, the slides will be mostly available in the majority of your screen right here. We'll be controlling movement. If you're looking for copies of the slides, you can page through on your own. You'll find those on the seminar homepage, which is available as a hyperlink on the right side of your screen. If you want to make the slides bigger, there is a full screen button in the upper right corner. You can click that once to turn on the full screen view. If you click it a second time, it'll shrink the slides back down. To the right, you'll see our Kluwen logo, and then again below that, the related URLs, and then in the lower right corner, that all-important Q&A window. You can privately submit your comments and questions by typing them up in this box in the lower right corner, and then clicking the cartoon bubble or hitting enter to submit them. think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have. Before we close things out, I will remind everyone how you can get a certificate for participating, provide feedback, and again, how to access the materials and recordings. So with that, I think I'm ready to turn things over to our primary instructors today, Earl Liverman and Jim Mullins.
Thank you, Jean, and welcome everyone. We have a very diverse audience, and we're very pleased with that, and we look forward to your comments, and in particular, any suggestions that you may offer at the end of the course. This is the first time we've done that, and we would be very appreciative of your thoughts and suggestions as to how we can make things better should this be offered again. By way of introduction for myself, I am a federal on-scene coordinator that is stationed in North Idaho. I've been with EPA since 1991, and I've been in North Idaho since 1994 and have dealt with a wide variety of removal and emergency response actions. We're very fortunate to have Jim Mullins, who has had a long and distinguished career with EPA in Region 6 before he retired a few years ago, and his emphasis has been, or was rather, an oil spill and hazardous waste response. Along with Jim and myself, we also have Bob Whittier. Bob Whittier is a Region 10 OSC that's stationed up in Anchorage, Alaska. Prior to joining EPA about 5 years ago, Bob similarly had a long and distinguished career with a state agency on the East Coast dealing with emergency response and preparedness issues. All right, welcome, and let's get started. We've gone over the instructors. We've briefly acknowledged a very large and diverse crowd from throughout the country, internationally, and with a wide variety of experience. With respect to the course as a whole, this slide just simply gives you a sense as to where we're going. It's important to note that there's no way to include all possible subjects, references, or guidance for something as complex as incident response in a single course. However, it is hoped that this course will assist you when responding to pipeline emergencies. This is the agenda. As we begin each of the different modules, we'll flash this slide up onto the screen, and the red highlights will show you where we are with respect to the overall presentation. The introductory module will provide an overview of the pipeline transportation system as a whole. Pipelines are an integral part of our society. Crude oil pipelines, liquid pipelines, and gas pipelines are operated by approximately 3,000 large and small companies throughout the country. Most hazardous liquid and gas pipelines are buried underground in rights of way, which is why perhaps many of you may have never before noticed them. And on this note, it's always important to call before you dig, because I suspect we're all very familiar with those instances of when someone has failed to do locate or not recognize the limitations of the locate, someone has struck something. Natural gas provides for fully 24% of our country's total energy consumption, and petroleum provides for another 39%. This map depicts all commodity pipelines, and that includes crude oil pipelines, which refers to petroleum taken directly out of the ground, liquid pipelines. The most common liquids transported by pipelines are refined petroleum products such as gasoline, jet fuels, diesel fuel, and home heating oil, and gas pipelines. And the most common gas product transported is natural gas. We will talk about all of these pipelines and modules yet to come. And it's important to note that while pipelines are found in all EPA regions, they're not evenly distributed. So, for example, Region 10, which is up to your upper left, includes the states of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, And when you compare that to Region 6, which includes the states of Texas and Oklahoma, as well as Louisiana, you'll see that there's a considerable difference in the pipelines, although I suspect Bob would be quick to add that while we may have few in Region 10, we have one big one up in Alaska, and we'll get a chance.
Yeah, we got the big one, 800-mile Trans-Alaska pipeline, along with about 2,000 miles of flow lines and gathering lines on the North Slope.
So that makes up for a lot of small ones. Okay, some more information on the pipeline transportation system. And what you see in the lower left slide is a typical natural gas drill rig, and to the right is a typical well. Now, this map focuses on only natural gas pipelines. Here's some more information about the interstate and intrastate gas transmission lines. It's important to note that the most common or important type of natural gas storage is in underground reservoirs, consisting largely of depleted gas reservoirs and salt cavern reservoirs. So in brief summary, pipeline incidents can bring a wide range of organizations to the scene, and we're going to talk about several of those here in a moment. The type of respondents will be depend not only on the scope and the nature of the incident, but also on the statutory authorities that are out there, particularly for EPA, that would enable EPA to respond to an incident. Most importantly, irrespective of who shows up, the key to success is to have a coordinated incident command structure where all of the respondents integrate their resources in a safe and efficient manner. Okay, before we move on to the second module, or rather the third module, are there any questions that we might, that anyone might have so far?
Right now I don't see any questions that have come in electronically, but this is a reminder to the participants. You guys can type up comments and questions in the Q&A window in the lower right corner at any time, and we will have these designated breaks throughout our talk, and then we'll start reading them out loud for an answer. So I actually think you can probably carry on, but we will continue to queue up those questions as they come in.
Thank you, Jean. All right, this slide shows us where we're at. We're about to begin the module entitled Basic Types of Pipelines. And the purpose of this module is to provide an overview of those basic types of pipelines, the three that I mentioned just a few moments ago. Petroleum pipeline systems. From the wellhead to the consumer, petroleum pipeline systems provide us with energy fuels and products that we use every day. There are essentially three major types of pipelines that are used along the pipeline, or rather the petroleum transportation route, and that includes gathering pipelines, crude oil pipeline systems, and refined products pipeline systems. And on this note, Jim, I'd like to handle it over to you, given the depth and breadth of experience that you have from Region 6.
Thanks, Earl. You flatter me. Perhaps unjustifiably. This diagram that Earl's going over here is really a pretty good one. It talks about, if you look at it carefully and study it a bit, in the upper left-hand corner you have wellheads, and in the bottom left you have ships, and these are the sources of the petroleum. It goes through pipelines, gathering lines, and then to pipelines to the refinery in the center. Then to downstream manufacturers and consumers. In the far right, lower right corner, you have distribution points, and the consumers are down there. So that's a pattern that's going to become familiar to you. We'll go through it a couple of different times, different ways, different looks today. Crude oil is one of the two basic big kinds of pipeline. It certainly talks about, these are about petroleum taken directly out of the ground from the wellhead, and the wellheads can be onshore or offshore. Lots of wellheads in the Gulf of Mexico. the composition of what comes out of the ground is a combination of oil and water usually, and the water is separated out and generally put back in the formation. The composition varies depending on where you are in the world, and I would suggest to you that it's unique enough that the chemists have developed a way to fingerprint it. So there's ways to look at this analytically and come up with fingerprints. This size of these lines vary quite a bit. The gathering lines are the smallest ones, and they go from usually 2 inches up to 8 inches in diameter. And they bring the well from the wellhead to a water separator and then to a processing facility where they're stored and taken into the larger pipeline. The trunk lines vary in size, too. They go from about 8 inches up to about 24 inches on the crude oil lines.
Yeah, and one thing, if I can add, Jim, that if we could go back, the picture that you see on the lower right is a picture of perhaps the most recognized crude oil trunk line that Bob referred to earlier, and that is the 800-mile-long Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, or TAPS.
Good.
All right, Jim, thank you.
Common liquids are crude oil and refined petroleum products. The refined products are shown for you in a list here. I'm not going to read them off to you. Obviously, the last one on the list, the anhydrous ammonia, is not a refined petroleum product, but it is transported in a liquid pipeline. And these are generally downstream of the refinery, and they vary in size from 8 to 42 inches. I would submit to you that a 42-inch transmission line carries a lot of material. Okay. All right. We're going now to marketing and distribution. This can go a variety of different ways, rail cars, trucks, barges, and so forth. The refined products often carry several different liquid products sequentially in the same line. Now, that's going to be important to us. That's a key point, and especially to responders to pipeline incidents, because you may start with one product coming out of a ruptured line and wind up with another one shortly thereafter. We'll go into that later. All right, liquid pipelines carrying highly volatile liquids. The takeaway message from this slide is that everything you see on here is under pressure. It's at natural, at normal temperatures and pressures, atmosphere. These materials are not liquids, but they're gas, and they've been compressed, and so there's a lot of energy in these as far as the compressors putting lots of energy into them to liquefy them. They cool them and liquefy them, and when you see a rupture of these, the characteristic is it's called highly volatile because it forms a vapor cloud. Here's another take on this pipeline system. This is a natural gas pipeline diagram, and it's very similar to what you saw on the crude oil pipeline. At the upper left, you have small diameter pipelines that are at or near the wellheads. They gather, and the lower left, you have ships bringing it in. You have transmission lines through the center of the diagram, and these are large diameter pipes. And then on the right-hand side, in the lower right corner, you have distribution lines from the natural gas system. And these are, once again, smaller diameters. So it starts in a small diameter pipe, goes to a large diameter pipe for transmission. Then for distribution, it goes back to a small diameter pipe. 48 inches is a large diameter pipe, natural gas. Transmission pipe, and that's 4 feet in diameter. You can move a tremendous volume of material through that. When it goes to the residential customers and the industrial customers, the service lines and distribution lines range down as low as half an inch in diameter. All right, now that's an overview of the pipeline systems. Do we have any questions, Gene?
Well, sorry about that. That was an issue on my end. We did have a question come in. One of the participants would like to know if you can define NG and NGL.
NG is natural gas. NGL is natural gas liquid, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, as we're waiting for questions, we just want to emphasize that this whole topic of pipelines is extraordinarily large. There's no way that we could humanly expect to cover it in the few minutes that we've discussed it there, other than to let you know that there are, in essence, three major types of pipelines along the transportation route, if you will, and that's gathering systems, transmission systems, and distribution systems pipelines.
Okay, Earl.
All right. Here we are. We're moving into the next module. Pipeline design, construction, and operations are governed by a wide array of local, state, and federal laws, regulations, and ordinances. In addition, there are industry voluntary consensus standards and industry best practices to help ensure that pipelines are safely operated and maintained. The purpose of this module is to provide an overview of certain statutes, executive orders, and regulations so that you can better understand EPA's statutory and regulatory authority for responding to a pipeline incident. This slide depicts EPA's emergency response authorities. And we'll focus on several of these statutes in particular in just a few moments. And those are the Federal Water Pollution Control Act amendments, or the Clean Water Act of 1972, OPA, as well as the Stafford Act. We're also going to talk very briefly about CERCLA, not so much from the perspective of responding, but with respect to the difference between CERCLA and the Clean Water Act, or OPA, in large part because those are the two dominant statutory authorities that EPA on-scene coordinators commonly deal with. And then, as you can well imagine, there's executive orders, as well as Homeland Security presidential directives that are there that could be used to trigger EPA involvement. Okay, with respect to the Clean Water Act, that was created by Congress in 1948 and was the first major law to address water pollution. While it's hard to imagine today discharging raw sewage and pollution into our harbors and rivers had been commonplace for most of the nation's history with devastating results. For example, by the late 1960s, Lake Erie had become so polluted that Time magazine described it as dead, and bacteria levels in the Hudson River were 170 times above the safe limit. In 1972, this landmark law reversed its course, so to speak, and the course of this behavior, and the Act took on a completely new approach to environmental protection. The Clean Water Act made it unlawful to discharge any pollutant from a point source into navigable waters unless a permit was obtained. This permit is referred to as the NPDES, or National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit. There were no more open sewers dumping waste into the local stream or bay. Waste that was otherwise flushed down drains and toilets was addressed from a different perspective, and that perspective is that the Clean Water Act provided for billions of dollars in grants to construct and upgrade publicly owned sewage treatment works found throughout the nation, and then to protect lands that filter and purify water as it flows by. Permits were also required for draining and filling wetlands, and these are those permits that are commonly referred to as 404 permits. The criteria for initiating EPA's response are several. In other words, we just simply cannot go out and say we're using OPA or we're using CERCLA. Rather, there are certain criteria, and those threshold criteria includes, is a substance involved an oil? And we will talk that about that more later on. Is the discharge, or is there a discharge, a substantial threat of discharge? We'll also talk about that. Is the discharge or substantial threat of discharge into navigable waters or adjoining shorelines? And removal actions must be consistent with the NCP. The substantial threat determination, keep in mind now that there can either be a discharge or a substantial threat determination. And we have a small exercise coming up that will illustrate better this notion of substantial threat. There's no single definition as to what that means. This particular definition comes out of the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, that deals with facilities transferring oil or hazardous material in bulk. And there's a, what this gives you are, you know, a certain criteria that one may take into consideration. There is another definition that's found in 40 CFR Part 112, which is the Oil Pollution Prevention Regulation. And again, it doesn't tell you specifically what substantial threat is, but rather it helps you to understand what those criteria are that an OSC might consider. And that includes such things as location. Could the threat reasonably be expected to discharge oil in quantities that may be harmful, as described in Part 110? And we'll talk about that in a moment. But in a nutshell, that is the regulation that is oftentimes referred to as the Sheen Rule. And it's also, you know, the sole example of a federal cleanup standard, if you will, that would have to be met in order to respond. Here's another discussion out of the NCP, and this is factors to be considered include but are not limited to the size of the discharge, the character of the discharge, the nature of the threat, and the likes. Now, those criteria are a little bit different than CERCLA. You'll recall that the nexus for using the Clean Water Act or OPA are surface waters of the U.S. CERCLA is different. CERCLA can be used in those instances when there is a release or threatened release into the environment of a hazardous substance or pollutant or contaminant. Now, the list of hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants is lengthy. There are about 800 that are identified in CERCLA, but then we also can identify contaminants that come into play through the Clean Water Act, through the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act. So there's a number of them out there. The conditions, there are a number of conditions that are laid out in the NCP that OSCs must meet in order to support a response. And those conditions include such things as threats to human health and the environment, threats to drinking water supplies or critical habitats, explosion or fire threats, instances where there may be no other federal, state, or local entity that has the ability to respond and the like. And again, similar to the Clean Water Act, the removal actions must be consistent with the NCP, and our sideboards with respect to the NCP are very, very broad. Just some additional information with respect to CERCLA and what is referred to as the petroleum exclusion. And this is the reason why, in most but not all instances, why CERCLA cannot be used to respond. There is what's referred to as a petroleum exclusion. And what this means is that by definition, both in the statute itself as well as the NCP, we cannot use that authority to respond to petroleum. And petroleum includes any crude oil or any fraction thereof unless specifically listed or designated under CERCLA. And there's more to that. The term pollutant or contaminant cannot be used. You'll recall there's hazardous substances, there's pollutants or contaminants. And with respect to the latter, again, petroleum is excluded. EPA interprets CERCLA to exclude crude oil and any fractions. This includes any hazardous substances that are normally mixed with or added to crude oil or crude oil fractions during the refining process. Jim, would you like to add one or two comments to this notion of exclusion, particularly with respect to refined products?
Well, it's absolute for one thing. There should be no exceptions to it. The crafters of the statute did not envision using this for anything relating to petroleum or any of the fractions of petroleum, the refined fractions of petroleum. The root reason behind that is that the petroleum lobby had a strong influence during the generation of that statute. I guess it came out in 1980, and it's kind of a demonstration that the democracy we live in is not perfect. It's just the best form of government on earth.
All right, sir. Thank you. Now, there might be those instances when CERCLA could be used, albeit they may be far and few in between. Some examples that would not fall under the scope of the exclusion would include PCBs mixed with oil, pesticides in an oil-based carrier or propellant, oil-based paints or solvents, and used oil contaminated with hazardous substances, solvents that are not typically intrinsically a part of the chemical makeup of petroleum. Okay, another act that EPA might be able to use is what's referred to as the Stafford Act. This act was enacted in 1974, and what it does is this provides states and I believe other local entities to request the assistance of the federal government if in the event the magnitude of the incident simply overwhelms their response capabilities. And what you see here, the lower left is a slide taken during Katrina Rita, and the slide to the right is an example of a Midwest flood that EPA was involved with as a result of the Stafford Act. Generally, what happens is that under the Stafford Act, there are any number of functions that are spelled out. These are referred to as ESF, or environmental support functions. The function that EPA typically works under is oil and hazardous materials. And so were we to deploy, in this instance, to, for an example, I mentioned earlier that the discharge of oil regulation or the Sheen rule. In other words, in order, there has to be a discharge or the threat of a discharge. And what that means to us with respect to the discharge is that a discharge that causes a sheen or a discoloration on the surface of a water body. So a sheen could be all that it takes. Discharges that violate applicable water quality standards or discharges that might cause a sludge or an emulsion. Now there are exceptions to this. There's certain exemptions. So for example, if you have a properly functioning vessel engine that there is a minor discharge from, those are not deemed to be harmful. If there are research and development releases that have been approved by the EPA administrator, those would be exempted. NPDES permitted discharges, and there are certain discharges in the territorial seas that might otherwise be permitted under international law that would be excluded from the scope of this regulation. Here's a definition of what sheen and sludge means. It's important to note that simply because you have a sheen, that is not in and of itself absolute. Rather, that is just the initial threshold that we have to get over, so to speak. And then after having gotten over that, you'll recall that there are any number of criteria then that the OSCs and others would take into consideration, such as size of discharge, the character of the discharge, the threat to human health or the environment and the like. All right, I'd like to spend just a few moments talking about the NCP. The NCP, or the National Oil and Hazardous Pollution Contingency Plan, is the federal government's blueprint for responding to both oil spills and hazardous substances releases. It is the result of our country's effort to develop a national response capability and to promote overall coordination among the hierarchy of responders and contingency plans. That hierarchy can include one or more federal entities, one or more state entities, one or more local entities, one or more tribal entities. It may include one or more responsible parties and the like. And so this was an attempt to come up with a means for coordinating all of this. One of the things that's important is the first bullet item, and this item provides the wherewithal for OSCs to direct response efforts and to coordinate all other efforts at the scene of a discharge or a release. And I'd also like to mention the last bullet item. Within the NCP, there is a broad range of federal agencies that are called out that are available at the request of an OSC to provide certain assistance. These include the Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry, Department of Commerce, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Department of Interior, Department of Transportation, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Department of Agriculture, within agriculture, the Forest Service, FEMA, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Navy, and the like, and that is not a complete list. What you'll also find in the NCP are certain things of other great assistance. The NCP establishes the national priorities for responding to a discharge. So you need not worry about what those overarching priorities are, which include safety, stabilize the situation, and ensure a timely, effective response that minimizes the adverse impact to the environment. Having that template, you can then follow on with all of those other objectives that would typically be put in your 202s that describe what your objectives are for any given operational period. And then the NCP also gives you a general sense as to what the pattern of response will be, and that runs from the investigation, the classification of the size and type, discovery or notification requirements, oversight of RP cleanup activities, whether or not other entities can come on board and with your oversight assist in the conduct of cleanup activities, notification of other parties such as tribes and natural resource trustees. Of all of these bullet items here, perhaps the most important one to call out is the last, and that's Appendix E to Part 300. Part 300 refers to the NCP. As opposed to wading through all of the different parts of the NCP related to oil spill response, not only the general requirements, but the specific requirements, you're fortunate in that you can go to Appendix E, and that is a summary of all of those requirements that are found in the NCP. It's a very handy pullout, and it's I use it every time I go out in response as I think about not only what I need to do going out the door, but also what I have to do once I arrive on site. And one of the things that can also be very, very helpful for is that there are instances where you might find yourself dealing with different persons and groups who are not familiar with the NCP, which, and as a result, you have to spend time explaining to them what the scope of your authority is, what the involvement of others might be, and the like. Well, and having a copy of this can be very helpful. I'm not going to suggest to you that it's not complicated, but it's just one means of giving some information out to different responders and others to help them understand why you were there and what the scope of your roles and responsibilities are. Now, should we ever have to respond to a pipeline incident, one of the most important partners in that would be PHMSA, or the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They have their own particular set of statutes that are there, and they have the in-depth expertise to help you better understand pipeline construction, maintenance and operation, and the like. And there's many and varied places that they could fit in to the overall command structure, our incident response structure. They could come in as technical specialists and the planning section and operations. They might come in and be deputy incident commander to the incident commander, depending upon the severity of the incident that you might be dealing with. PHMSA's base programs include inspection, enforcement, and emergency response. Perhaps you'll recognize the little guidebook that you see in the lower right. It's one of the documents that they're responsible for, prevention and public education and the like. So they could have very tangible roles, not only with respect to the technical features of the pipeline, perhaps as well as perhaps the outreach efforts, so as to take very complicated concepts and put them in a way that the public can understand, better understand and appreciate. As is often the case with any federal agency, they're organized into a number of different regions. All right, PHMSA from an FOSC spill response perspective, and that's a federal on-scene coordinator such as Bob or myself, and by the way, the NCP divides up an FOSC's responsibilities between what's referred to as inland and marine or coastal, if you will. The FOSC for inland areas, the EPA, while the FOSC for coastal and marine areas is the United States Coast Guard. And generally, those boundaries oftentimes are some given measurement from a shoreline, perhaps it's 1,000 feet, or maybe they might focus on a man-made structure, such as a bridge or something such as that. So PHMSA, from an FOSC's perspective, the OSC is responsible for response operations. PHMSA is not a response agency. Rather, they function as a technical specialist. You should not hesitate whatsoever to ask for assistance. We'll get to a brief exercise here regarding the TAPS, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, where we had a representative of PHMSA on site. It proved to be invaluable in better understanding what was going on. PHMSA's responsible for repair and the resumption of pipeline operations. So you respond, they fix and resume. And there's also a preparedness component that's associated with pipeline operations, and that is they have to develop response plans that outline planning, training, response, and the like. Another important player in the overall regulatory framework is state and local government. A state or local government may adopt additional or more stringent regulations, provided they are consistent and compatible with other federal regulations. The state public utilities or public service commissions manage intrastate pipeline issues in many states. The state fire marshal's office is typically responsible for the regulation of flammable liquids and gases. The State Department of the Environment is oftentimes responsible for the development and enforcement of environmental safety regulations, such as contingency plans and the like. You also have state and county emergency management agencies that are directly responsible for local emergency planning and the like. And then, of course, you have the local fire departments that enforce fire prevention and hazardous materials codes. There's also what's referred to as voluntary consensus standards. Normally, these types of standards are developed through professional organizations or trade associations as a method of improving quality of a product or system. The National Gas Association represents local energy distribution companies that deliver natural gas to homes, business, and industries. The American National Standards Institute establishes processes and procedures, procedural requirements for the standards development process. In other words, if you develop standards for a particular field, what is the framework for doing so as to ensure they're reliable and whatnot. API, or the American Petroleum Institute, the National Trade Association for the Petroleum Industry, and then the National Fire Protection Association, which is an association devoted to fire prevention and safety. All right, we're at that rule, or the SPCC rule. So in our primary statutes as federal OSCs, and we're typically assigned to a division such as the Environmental Cleanup Division, or it might be the Emergency Response Branch or something like that, but the statutes that we commonly use are CERCLA and the Clean Water Act / OPA. Now, that doesn't mean that we enforce all aspects of CERCLA, for example. There's a whole group of RPMs, or remedial project managers, that deal with those long-term cleanup issues, and there are certain roles and responsibilities that they have that deal with long-term, non-time critical type cleanups. But as far as emergency response and time critical actions, whether it be related to CERCLA or discharges or threat of discharges to the Clean Water Act, we're the ones who are involved with that. Bob, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, as an OSC, there's a lot of overlap there. I mean, we have folks that deal with just the Clean Water Act, and then, as Earl alluded to, yeah, we have remedial folks that just focus on a certain aspect of CERCLA.
Good point. Region 10 is relatively small with respect to the number of OSCs that we have assigned. I think we have about 14 or 15 at last count. And because we're so small, all of us will deal with all statutes as opposed to other regions that are larger, who might have 30 or 40 OSCs. And in those instances, it would then be common to find OSCs that deal exclusively with CERCLA or exclusively with oil or exclusively with preparedness or something of that nature. All right, Jean, I think that's
okay.
It.
We do have another question, and one of our participants would like to know if produced water can be regulated under CERCLA.
If what?
Produced water.
Produced water?
It's non-CERCLA.
Yeah, the only way that, again, that CERCLA can be triggered is if there are hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants. And if produced water is void of that or otherwise exempted, then no, it would not be regulated under CERCLA.
Okay. We did have another participant that wanted to know, or the question was, FOSC uses CERCLA to respond to a gas or gas liquid incident. Is that correct?
Gas is exempt.
Say again, Bob?
Gas is exempt. Propane is exempt.
Right. The only instance that CERCLA could be approved, given the petroleum exclusion, would be an instance where there was something that was added to the product that would otherwise allow us to use CERCLA. And I gave a couple of examples. Let's say you had a pipeline that, for whatever reason, had PCBs mixed in with the oil. Or let's say you had used oil, a pipeline that in some manner was conveying used oil from one structure to another or something of that nature, and it just so happened that there were hazardous substances in that, then you could use CERCLA. But other than that, you could not. And then with respect to the Clean Water Act, you have to have the nexus with surface waters of the U.S. If you do not have that nexus, either as an actual or a substantial threat, then you cannot use the Clean Water Act, and we've got no business being there. And except,
I mean, there's a lot of cases out there. I mean, take gasoline for example. It's hazardous by its own nature. Benzene, is, of course, is flammable, but, you know, you have a spill just the soil. I mean, it endangers properties and that type of thing, and there's no nearby navigable waters. We're out of the picture as a federal entity.
Right, and then, you know, refined product intrinsically has, for example, benzene or stuff like that. So you can't use the intrinsic nature of the product as a means for short-circuiting the statute and coming in with some other statute such as CERCLA.
And that's simply where the state folks come in. I mean, you know, Clean Water Act, it's not the Clean Dirt Act. I mean, they have definitely considerations where there's a spill to soil, there's effects to groundwater, that type of thing.
Excellent point. Thank you, Bob.
Okay, again, we do have some participants circling back. They're still not quite clear. Who is the one responding to a gas pipeline threat?
Well,
primarily state and fire officials.
Right. You know, EPA, there's different levels or categories. Let's use Idaho as an example. Idaho classifies its incidents on a scale running from regulatory to 1, 2, and 3. 1 is local responders. 2, state responders can come into play and complement the local responders' capability. And 3 is when assistance from the feds are needed. Most of these pipeline incidents are dealt with by other entities besides EPA. We would only get involved if in the event we had that statutory nexus to be able to do so, and then that there was yet another compelling reason to become involved. That reason might be related to our trustee relationships with respect to natural resource trustees or tribes. It might be related to the criticality of the resource, such as, is it a federally designated wild and scenic river system, or might there be Section 7 Endangered Species Act issues and the like. And so does that help to give you a better sense as to what our sideboards are?
Yeah, I think that definitely helps answer the question here. And we do have some participants just kind of going on that a lot of states have differences, and they might have different plans in place. We did have Jim also commented as well that your gas pipelines are usually regulated by the Department of Transportation regulations, DOT regs.
Yeah, pipeline transportation is a big part of the Department of Transportation's work, and they're absolutely and clearly regulated by the Department of Transportation, rather heavily so. So EPA has a relatively a sideline jurisdictional authority with regard to pipelines. Congress has always been rather mindful about providing overlapping jurisdiction to different federal agencies, and the principal regulator of pipelines is the Department of Transportation.
You're absolutely right, Jim, and PHMSA is an agency within the Department of Transportation. And again, it's DOT that has the regulations. For example, the 49 CFR Parts 190 to 199 regulations. Those are safety regulations that govern the design, construction, operation, safety, and maintenance of interstate pipelines. But also recall, you know, PHMSA from an OSC's perspective. The OSC is responsible for response operations should we be there because of some statutory authority, some regulatory nexus that gets us there. We just deal with the release or the threat. We don't deal with repair. We don't deal with resumption. We don't deal with any of those types of things that are otherwise the role and responsibility of DOT.
That's good. Have we got more questions, Jean?
No, I think in the interest of time, let's go ahead and continue on. Just reminding everybody, we are on slide number 57, and it's approximately 3 p.m. Eastern, so we've got about 2 hours left.
Okay, well, we're going to turn this over to the our sage elder, Mr. Mullins, and we're hopefully these scenarios will serve to illustrate the different types of issues that are a part of the statutes that we have available. I wish I could say to you that everyone was easy. It's not. They're very complicated, and hopefully these modules will help. So, Jim, take it away, sir.
All right. We'll go through several of these. These scenarios are based on things that an OSC may commonly encounter. So these are, you know, not out of line as far as expected happenings. And what we'll do is we'll present a scenario, and then we'll have a question and answer session, and that's going to be quite interactive. Let's go ahead and start, if we can, with scenario one. We have an alarm sounding at a pipeline control center. The pipeline control center initiates a call with the federal, the state, and the locals and says, here's what we know. We got a 24-inch crude oil transmission pipeline that's putting oil out. And here is a crude map that is provided to you for consideration. This is all we know initially. The pipeline crosses from left to right or right to left about the center of the screen. In the lower left corner, there is a stream. The left one-third, you see the spill below the surface of the snow. It's just north of a maintenance building and not too far from a clubhouse on the lower right corner. So that's the scenario. Okay, and we're going to pose a question now. Does EPA have the Clean Water Act, Oil Pollution Act authority to respond to this incident? The Pipeline Control Center is asking for help, and you're on the EPA's red phone. You're the duty officer. How are you going to respond? And if you will, take about the next 15 or 20 seconds and click one of these circles down here, and we'll broadcast the results and let you look at them. Okay, that should just about do it. Finish up, if you will. Earl, what's the answer here?
Well, it depends. You'll recall that one of the earlier slides, there were four steps that we OSCs go through in determining whether or not they can use the Clean Water Act Section 311 authority. Is the substance involved in oil? Is there a discharge or substantial threat of discharge? Is the discharge a substantial threat of discharge into navigable waters or adjoining shorelines? And are removal actions consistent with the NCP? Well, if we can go back to the little scenario map for just a moment, you know, it seemed to be that you might have that. You know you have an oil. You know you have a discharge. But what you have to ask yourself, is there a substantial threat of discharge to the stream or pond? Here's the stream. Here's the pond. Are those navigable waters of the U.S.? Now, it's depending upon how you make those determinations, you may or may not be able to respond. So my answer to this would be, I need to get some additional information. As the phone duty officer, I'm going to be calling the National Response Center, which is where notifications of incidents such as this should be made. I'll be calling the RP back to get a better understanding of the topography of the landscape, what is the size of the release, what might the threats of the release be, what is the stream, is it intermittent, is it perennial, is the pond a farm pond that's filled with three or four bluegills, or is it something greater than that? So the answer is it depends, and it's just the beginning of the phone duty officer's efforts to collect information so that he could make that decision or she could make that decision.
All right, let's refine that, Earl. Would your answer change if the pond in the previous picture was a swale or an erosional feature, and if the ditch drained only uplands with no permanent flows?
Yes, it very well could. However, intermittent flows under a certain set of circumstances could help to create that nexus. But generally, if you just have a ditch that's in upland areas and drains only upland areas, and that does not carry a relatively permanent flow, then no, you would not. And so what you see here on the left is perhaps nothing more than a drainage swale that allows for passive infiltration. And here on the right, you might have a drainage ditch that flows only during storm events and major events at that. So yes, it could change.
All right, very good. Let's go to the next scenario. This is number two. We have a local fire department responding to a 20-inch liquid transmission line that's carrying gasoline in an urban area. And the red phone duty officer is in the Regional Emergency Operations Center, and there's TV coverage on the TV screen that's always playing in the Regional Emergency Operations Center, and there's abundant number of reporters around. So we got a 20-inch gasoline line that's ruptured in an urban area. There's a fire department response. There's lots of TV coverage and plenty of reporters. I'm going to show you the map of that. The pipeline runs from lower left to upper right. That's gasoline line. And you see about the center of the screen a track hoe that's struck the line. You see the wind direction. Just below the wind arrow, you see a crowd gathering there. And this is the map that's shown on TV by the reporters. And it turns out that we have a new regional administrator who has just been appointed. He sees the television coverage, sees the crowd, sees the map, and the new RA wants to know, do we have authority to send our EPA resource and responders to this incident? Now, this is the big boss asking you this now. So you're the phone duty officer. What sort of response are you going to give him? Yes, no, or maybe? Take a few moments, if you will, and vote on the interactive screen. We'll give you a few more seconds to finish that. All right. Earl, what's your answer?
Well, we have two no's and a maybe. Going back to the image, it was left purposefully vague. So one of the things I hope you noticed is there's no evidence of surface waters. And so the first statement, Clean Water Act, OPA, no, because you did not meet those threshold criteria, surface waters of the U.S. And with respect to CERCLA, no, because of the petroleum exclusion. Now, there is one possibility that might come into play, and that is within Region 10, and I suspect other regions as well, EPA is noted for its air monitoring capabilities. So even though we did not respond directly using our statutory authorities, we may be requested to provide assistance to incident command given that air monitoring expertise. So if that were to be the case, and what might trigger this is a large crowd. So, you know, we might be able to come in and assist supporting capacity, but with respect to the fact pattern we gave you, no. But as a good PDO, if you've got the big dog breathing down your back, you might say something like, can I have a few moments and get back to you?
Yeah. Hey, Earl, you know, in another instance, there are those situations there where, you know, you're covering things from afar. You may not have all the answers. I mean, you may have to actually go out there and actually conduct an assessment. I mean,
That's a good point, and perhaps we can use this as an opportunity to answer a question regarding the NRC. All regions have what's referred to as a PDO or phone duty officer and an RDO or a response duty officer. So, for example, if I were the phone duty officer and I received this phone call, the NRC report is sketchy, I can't get through to the RP, but because I have some familiarity with the area, I know that there are resources there that might be at risk or relationships with different entities that might be important. And if that were to be the case, then without reservation, I can dispatch Bob or I can dispatch our contractors to go out, get some eyes on the ground, to see what's going on and provide more information back to the mothership so as to make clear decisions. Now, there was a question about what if the NRC was contacted first? Would the NRC contact the FOSC? The answer to that is yes, but that assumes that an entity knows to contact the Federal Response Center. Generally, there are two levels of notification. There's the federal level, which is our level, and when a report goes in to the NRC, the NRC then flashes that out to any number of different agencies. On the other hand, many states have their own notification system, and it's not the responsibility of the state to notify the National Response Center or to tell callers that they need to notify the NRC. Many do, but they're not required to do so. So we can find out about an incident through the NRC, through state notification mechanisms, or we may very well find out about something through the press and media before it even is reported. If it happens to be in an urban area, it's amazing how quick with social media and whatnot things can come across. Okay.
Good. Let's go to scenario three if we're ready to move on. We have a backhoe striking a line. This is a natural gas line in a plastic pipe.
Is that your tractor, Jim?
Well, no, Bob, it's not, but I'm sure everybody's ready to conclude that everything we do involves a backhoe. So I apologize for these backhoe operators. They're usually not so bad. This backhoe strikes the line. There's an ignition of the natural gas and a release of it. There's a brush fire that erupts and starts moving toward a nearby oil storage facility. Now, let me show you a map of that. If you look on the left side, you see the wind direction. It's driving the fire from the upper left quadrant toward the oil storage tanks. And the pipeline runs from upper left to lower left. And this is going to raise a question here. This is all the information you have. We've established earlier that you may need to dispatch somebody to investigate if you truly do or don't have authority. But the question is, knowing what you know now, do you have Clean Water Act or CERCLA authority to respond to this incident? So you're visiting with a coworker from another program. You hear about it on the radio. Your coworker asks, are you going to send somebody? Do you have the authority to send somebody? And we'd like for you to interact with us on these questions. Answer, if you will, in the question below. And Earl, when you're ready, I'm going to ask you to take this away.
All right. Well, I wish it was as easy as this slide suggests. On face value, you're having a cup of coffee, and you think to yourself, well, hell no. Not under the Clean Water Act. Why? Because from this little picture that we saw, there is no water. So you say, nope, that's out of there. And so the next question you say is, okay, can't use CERCLA either because of the petroleum exclusion. But you take that second cup of Joe, that second sip of Joe, you go back to the site map, and you look at this. You see two tanks. You see a fire. Well, what happened? What would happen if there was a water body just to the essential threat of discharge? So again, I think this is a situation where on its face the answer is easy, but as you start to think a little bit more about it, as you know, you would want to pull back a little bit and look at things from a slightly broader perspective. And you'd want to ask yourself, you know, are these tanks that possible nexus, provided that there was something nearby such that if the fire were to get to one or both of those tanks, you could reasonably conclude that there was a substantial threat of discharge into navigable waters of the U.S.
All right, good.
All right, sir.
Let's move to the next one.
I think we got one more, Jim.
Yeah, there we go. All right, this is scenario four. We've had a fuel oil pipeline rupture. This happened to be a 6-inch diameter pipeline, which is a pretty good size fuel line. It was, for once, not hit by a backhoe. This is discovered after several hours of leaking. And there's about 15,000 gallons, or around 350 barrels, of fuel oil that have escaped to a brackish marsh. Now, a brackish marsh is a marsh with some salt water in it. And here's a map of the situation. The pipeline runs like this. The rupture is here at the red dot. The power generating station is burning the oil over here. And you'll notice in the water, here's the marshy area that was saturated with the oil, and it's gotten into this part of the bay here, and you can see the oil on the water. Okay. Does EPA have Clean Water Act OPA authority to respond to this incident? You're the phone duty officer and get a National Response Center call. You go to your boss and say, boss, we got this going on, and the boss says, what do you think we should do? I'd like to have your advice entered into the interactive question below, please. Earl, when you're ready, you may proceed.
All right. Okay, well, this is kind of a trick answer here, so bear with me. With respect to the statute itself, yes. Some entity has the ability to respond. But the question is, should EPA respond? And recall that I very briefly mentioned that there's two types of federal OSCs. There's Coast Guard and there's EPA. And so the first question you would have to consider is, going back to your diagram, is where along the shoreline is that bright line drawn between the Coast Guard's authority and yours? Maybe it's here, maybe it's not. Who knows what type of agreements or understanding you might have and the like.
And one note, Earl, too, under the NCP, you're only allowed one federal on-scene coordinator, one designated FOSC.
Yeah, the worst thing you need is two OSCs out there chasing a herd of cats, because it will get ugly. So you'd have to make that determination. However, even if you were to think of the Coast Guard as being it, there's nevertheless the opportunities for responsibility to shift. And here's an example. Let's say the impact, for whatever reason, while you've got some sheen, whatnot, occurring in the water, the real impact is felt further inland in some manner, or there's a greater threat yet to play itself out inland. Well, the NCP provides for those shifts between jurisdictional boundaries between the Coast Guard and EPA. So those bright lines they can be elastic depending upon a number of different variables.
Okay,
all right, sir.
Ready to move on. Let's go. I got to the right spot here. Forgive me. You advanced for me, Earl. Forgive me. This is the Alaska pipeline. This is up in Bob's territory. We got all the North Slope crude flowing into pump station 01, which is one of 11 pump stations. The leak was detected in the booster pump building basement at pump station 01. And the Trans-Alaska pipeline was shut down within an hour. And there was no release to the environment, but EPA is directed by headquarters to respond. And I think we have a map with this. No, we have a picture.
This is a tricky one.
Go ahead.
And you'll note that the biggest thing at Dead Horse is an airstrip. For all practical purposes, that's surface waters of the U.S. You want to speak to that a little bit, Bob?
Yeah, most of the North Slope tundra, it's wet tundra. It's considered navigable waters of the United States. I mean, you get those perennial lakes there, and actually flows very slowly towards the Beaufort Sea. So all that area up there, all that infrastructure is sitting over on top of navigable waters.
Okay, good. And
this pump station one incident is interesting. That's going to bring up a lot of questions.
This is the site map. This is the pump station here, right, Bob? Is this it? Or the building?
Correct. That's okay. The pump station, and those are two DOT breakout tanks.
And this is the location of the leak, right?
That was contained in the basement.
In the booster pump building.
Okay. So that's the situation. January 8th, 2011, this is a real live situation. Leak was detected, and the Trans-Alaska pipeline system was shut down in an hour. And the question is, does EPA have Clean Water Act authority or CERCLA authority to respond to this incident? Yes, no, or maybe. Earl, whenever you're ready, we'll let you take it away. And I think, do we have voting on this one? Yeah, we have interactive voting, so please
vote. All right. Well, this was interesting. CERCLA, no. Clean Water Act, yes. But we need to give you a little bit more. I tell you what, Bob, why don't you describe this, man?
Yeah, the situation was there was a manifold within the pump station building. There's a series of pumps there, and one of the manifold sections actually was underground in a concrete vault. Developed a leak, whether it was corrosion or whatever, and it was probably 1,000 gallons within the building. And obviously it didn't look like a threat to navigable waters. that being the case, I mean, this is January, you got 20 below, 40 below, you got an 800-mile-long pipeline. The whole pipeline shut down to the tune of 300,000 barrels per day. All the operators, everything on the North Slope goes through Pump Station 1, all the operators. So you get those 2,000 miles of flow lines and gathering lines going to the pump station. That being said, with the oil shutdown along the 800 miles, there was a lot of issues. You had water settling out, there were freeze potential, there were rupture potential. So therein lies the fact that there was a threat to navigable waters. There's like 50 major crossings, maybe 500 minor crossings over water. So that's the authority we responded to, just the threat of a discharge from that incident. Where you look at it on the surface, you got maybe 1,000 gallons that's confined to a basement area, no water around, not a big deal. We wouldn't respond under that. But because there was that substantial threat, we were able to respond. Earl, you want to add anything?
Well, and I'd also like to say is that if you're told to go by management, you go. And so, as you can well imagine, this was coming off the heels of BP, Yellowstone, Enbridge, and the like.
Yeah.
And then and there was...
Keep in mind, it's 15% of the nation's oil production that just got shut off, so it got political in a big hurry.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but it was one of the most fascinating responses. You know, when I heard 800 miles of line, subsurface, above ground, Buku oil and whatnot, yeah, we went up there. All right, sir. Thank you, Bob.
All right, let's move on to scenario six. This time we have a large natural gas line. This is a 36-inch transmission line. It ruptures near an apartment complex. It has 1,500 or so residents. Recognizing the impact on the, or potential impact on the community and the resources, the fire chief immediately requests federal assistance. I believe we have a map. Here it is. You can see this is a densely populated area. Here's the location of the fire, and the ruptured line runs from top to bottom like this. So that's the setting. And the question is, does EPA have authority to respond to this incident? Now, that's all the facts you have at this moment. And if you will, vote on this interactively. And Earl, when you're ready, please take it away.
Okay. At first blush, from a CERCLA perspective, no. From a Clean Water Act perspective, no. But you'd want to ask more questions. You know, there might be a nearby surface water. Even though it's a residential area, I suspect everyone's familiar with the story of Love Canal and what happened in Niagara Falls as residential areas encroached on former waste disposal areas. So there might be a landfill there or something. So you would want to ask those questions, and let's just assume hypothetically that no, there wasn't. But what could happen, you'll also recall from the site diagram that you're in a very densely populated area, and it's possible that the local responders in the state were ill-equipped because maybe there's multiple incidents going on or who knows what, and so the governor would have access to EPA through the Stafford Act out of a concern for the protection of property, public health, and safety. Who knows what the scope and scale of that might be, but EPAs, we're very creative in the resources that we can bring. For those of you who are familiar with the Columbia Shuttle, we responded to that. So likely no to OPA, CERCLA, but you should get some information. And perhaps from the Stafford Act, providing that there was a declaration from the governor requesting assistance. Now, one other thing to add to that comment about the Stafford Act, oftentimes that takes time. It could take days. It might take weeks. It's not inconceivable that EPA, using its own resources, could elect to respond to an incident and to do something over a relatively short amount of time. Whether that's 4 hours or 12 hours or 24 hours, who knows? But were EPA to do that, that would then allow time for the paperwork to catch up and work formally then under the Stafford Act.
Okay, right, let's go to the next scenario. This is 7, and we have very limited information. It's all going to appear on this one slide. This is what you got. Gasoline pipeline ruptures, releasing an estimated 116,000 gallons of gasoline to soil. That's all the information you got. There's a picture of it right there.
Yeah.
So if you will, please answer the question. Does EPA have the authority to respond to this incident? Yes, no, or maybe. And when the voting is ended, Earl, and you're comfortable, please move ahead.
All right, sir. Thank you. Well, we chose no. Just, you know, and showing you the picture of the pipeline, what we would have hoped you might have noticed is what appears to be a relatively arid, flat environment. And while we say no easily, you might want to call back the RP and no again from the Clean Water Act. Why? Because there isn't a nexus with surface waters of the U.S. It's not, as Matt Carr is fond of saying, the Dirty Soil Act. Does that mean nothing could happen? No. You'll recall Bob earlier mentioned that there are states has regulations, and in this instance, the state may be responding pursuant to some sort of a contingency plan requirement and the like.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting point here. I mean, there are those situations you get a large discharge of that, whether it's oil or gasoline, to permeable soil, say sand or silt, that type of thing. And there is the potential it gets to groundwater. There's that potential over time for it to get to navigable water, say a creek or a river. And I guess the question here, when do you determine a threat, when do you don't? It may take a year for it to get to navigable waters. Is that still a threat? I mean, what's your response to that, Earl?
Excellent comment, Bob. Let's play with that for a moment. Let's say there is a release, and it's a substantial release, and it travels 100 feet to groundwater, and the nearest surface water expression is 5 miles away. So you respond bright-eye and bushy-tail, and you start to look for a sheen, perhaps that's evidence on the surface water, and you don't see anything. And you periodically touch base with people over the course of the next year and ask them if they've seen sheens. And each and every time they say no. But 2 years later, lo and behold, there is a sheen. Then you could use your authorities to respond to the original release that happened, because you now have a threat. Up until that point, you couldn't discern whether there was a substantial threat, and you just concluded there wasn't. But because the product, as an L-NAPL, a light non-aqueous phase liquid, would float on the water table, generally at the speed of groundwater movement, it took 2 years to travel that far. It then came out onto a water body, and there, provided it met the criteria of navigable waters, you could trigger the Clean Water Act to come in here and deal with not only the product, but also the secondary sources of the release to the soil, and that would be the soil itself, to try to cut off the contribution. So good comment, Bob.
Yeah, one thing you have to be careful of, too, is spills like that. I mean, you got to be careful of conduits, underground utilities, that type of thing, storm drains, because that would have the potential of pushing it directly to a navigable water. So a lot of research needs to be done.
Old channels, too, stream channels that may have just been hidden over time. Okay, I think that brings us to the conclusion of that module. Jean, are there any questions?
Yeah, we did have a few questions. A couple of them came in throughout the course of the scenarios, with particular participants asking if things would have been differently. Couldn't you still respond to do some more investigation? Or, you know, wouldn't this scenario be different under a different set of regs, or depending on who you were coming to the site? But I think what I might best summarize it is a comment that just came in that, and perhaps we can kind of explain a little bit more about the purpose here. One participant said that you're qualifying all the scenarios with information that seems to be speculative, and it's not necessarily based on the very limited facts that were given up front. And they're not quite sure if why we're asking them what they should do, if the answer really is all that it depends.
Well, that's a good question. The first thing I would add is that we're limited in the amount of time that we have available to play with any of these scenarios. We probably could have taken one scenario and spent 3 hours on it. So the intent is to sort of begin to focus you on things that you might initially begin to want to consider. And I guess at its core, unless you have familiarity with the location where an incident might occur because of a geographic or assignment, something like that, in most, if not all instances, the answer is going to be maybe. You are going to want to call the RP, or you are going to want to call your state partners, or you are going to call the incident commander, who might be law enforcement or fire. But the idea behind these scenarios was just to sort of begin to put a template in your mind. What's the threshold criteria for the Clean Water Act? What's the threshold criteria for CERCLA? And what are some of those things, that those issues that help you make the determination of whether or not you get over those hurdles? The media, the amount of product, the location, so on and so forth. But you're right. But in large part, which is constrained by the amount of time that we have available, and we couldn't spend as much time as we might have otherwise all enjoyed doing.
One more comment on that, if I may. The learning point here is to make sure you understand what the limitations are on your authorities, and that's why we go into a lot of what-ifs, too, so that you understand the limitations a little better.
Got it. We do, though, have some really positive feedback coming in from the participants that they did enjoy the scenarios, and that it's been a very valuable part of the course. We do have another participant that would like to know if an RP is actively addressing a groundwater issue and working with the State Department of Environment, but a few years later, they observe a sheen on a nearby surface water. Does the state or the RP have responsibility to notify the federal entity?
Be a passerby and notice a sheen. You could be a hiker and notice a sheen. In this instance, whichever one was first to notify it, the expectation is that notification would be promptly made to the NRC. There is, once they're aware of it now, you can't notify if you're not aware. There's no time per se, but generally it's prompt notification. And what does that mean? 12, 18, 24 hours, 42, who knows?
Yeah, one thing too, Earl, is a lot of emphasis on our side of the coin, the federal side of the coin. But there are those instances out there where the state can take charge of the situation. We see that they're doing a great job, and they can, you know, do the cleanup. I mean, let them have at it. You know, it's the whole thing with the federal government unified command. The federal government has 51% of the vote, but we typically never throw that card unless we have to.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, going back to the notification coming out of the NRC, that notification goes not only to EPA's emergency response personnel, it goes also to EPA's investigatory personnel and any number of other federal and state agencies. So, for example, in the state of Washington, the clearinghouse for reporting in Washington is the Office of Emergency Management. The NRC notifies OEM, and in some instances, though, OEM may notify EPA. And typically the NRC will notify both the Coast Guard and EPA. But Bob is right. We might, in any given day, we might receive 20 notifications of an oil release or a discharge, excuse me. It can range from a few drops to 3 gallons at a gas station. Will we do anything with those? No. Typically we just log them. However, if that 3 gallons happens to go to a storm drain that spills right into, some other water body that has some significance as a Superfund site or something else, yes, we might respond. But generally, the state and lesser organizations deal with these matters. EPA never gets involved.
Okay, great. I think we're going to continue on with the presentations at this point in time. Remember, we're on slide number 88, and we have about an hour and 23 minutes left.
Okay, Mr. Mullins, this is your module.
It certainly is. Thank you. This is the pipeline operations module, and we'll step smartly through it. This is a diagram that's now becoming familiar to you. The gathering end of the pipeline is on the left margin of the picture, and the customers are down at the right end being distributed to, and transmission lines are in between, so there's no new magic in that picture. Here's another photograph of the same sort of thing. This one is for oil. The top left is oil field and gathers from the wellhead. The bottom left is tankers bringing in crude oil in bulk. Both of them run it up to a refinery in the upper right quadrant, which distributes to the refined petroleum products to the marketplace in terminals or through terminals, distribution terminals. We're going to talk a little bit about the basic design of pipelines. We'll show you some patterns on the next few slides. Once again, the similarities is the gathering systems are the small pipelines, 2 to 8 inches in diameter. Transmissions are the intermediate ones. It's 8 inches and larger, up to 40s in the 40s. And then distribution systems are on the far end, the smaller diameter lines going out to the customers. Here's the basic design we're going to talk about. It follows a riverine pattern. You would see this pattern. This could be a diagram of essentially any natural stream with the flow indicated by the head of the arrow in the lower left corner here. This would be the discharge point of this system. And the upper end of this in a pipeline would be the wellheads at the ends of the tributaries, the so-called headwaters of the river. And the gathering systems are the intermediate tributaries that are the 2 to 8 inch diameter pipelines. And then the transmission lines are the bigger lines on the 8 inches and larger on the main stem of the river, if you will. It's controlled and energized by either compressors or pump stations. Compressors if it's a gas, pump stations if it's a liquid. And this whole area encased in the red here is the well field. So there's nothing that's particularly mysterious about that. And if you were a neurologist, you might call it a dendritic pattern because it looks like a nerve cell. But I like the riverine analogy. If we're talking about gas pipelines on the distribution system, remember, this is going the other way. This is going upstream. This is going opposite the last diagram we looked at. And the first thing you see on the main stem is some meters and some valves that control the flow or measure the flow. And then at the end of the tributaries, you get to the consumers. Okay, we got some identification things we'll talk about briefly. This is a system of alerts to the public, really. Tells anybody that's around that sees these things, there's a pipeline close, and it's got some contact information on it. And you must have these markers at water crossings and road crossings, and you often have them at or near population centers, particularly in cities. You may see them even epoxy glued to a curb. Here's the styles, and I skipped the slide, excuse me.
What it is, Jim, is it just meant that the signs generally give you three bits of information. One, the contents. Two, who's the operator. And three, an emergency telephone number.
That's right. And forgive me, I just got off a slide, Earl. We're going to talk about the right-of-ways. These are variable between 25 and 150 feet wide. They're typically areas where the vegetation is either absent or carefully managed. These rights-of-ways are to enable access for inspection or for testing, and certainly for emergency response should that be necessary. These right-of-ways must provide a clear aerial view for inspection, and most of the right-of-ways of larger pipelines are aerially inspected very frequently. The activities in a right-of-way are restricted, specifically building, digging, that sort of thing. And the right-of-ways may run parallel to or with power line right-of-ways or sometimes even highway right-of-ways. Pumps and compressors we covered a little bit earlier. Valves and storage capacity we've talked about in tanks or gas reservoirs underground. And we'll talk again about the valves and controls on them. Now, this license tag down here is not to brag on the state of Texas, but this is about the National Call Before You Dig number. It's 811, and that's a national number. It's operated at the state level. It's like gravity. It's not just a good idea. It's the law. You need to call before you dig, and it'll affect your liability if you interrupt the transmission line and have not done the right thing by calling beforehand. So 811, know what's below.
Hey, Jim, I guess I'm mistaken. I thought for Texas and Louisiana it was BR, what, 159 or... I think I'm dating myself.
Yeah, I don't know how to respond to that. Okay, we got construction. 2 to 48 inches in diameter for trunk lines. Seamless steel or steel with a welded seam. It can be straight or longitudinal or spiral. And the joints of pipe are typically 40 to 60 foot sections. So this is big industry. It's a big consumer of steel material. And all of the joints of pipe are welded together. Now, the significance of that is that they're, when you think back to the maps we showed you earlier in the presentation, the country's crisscrossed with pipelines. That means there's a lot of weld joints in there. And corrosion is inhibited with coatings or wrappings that's often applied at the steel mill, but it could be applied on site. And often that's a bitumastic material to insulate the pipe or isolate the pipe from the soil in which it's buried. You usually drill to get directionally drill to get under a river. In fact, that is the current standard. Historically, there were more pipelines that were laid. They were not drilled under the bottom of the channel, but they were laid and weighted with some sort of anchor. That's not the standard practice anymore, except on perhaps some very small streams in some very rugged territory. All right, corrosion control, excuse me. This is a big deal. Corrosion is a natural process. Every pipeline operator has to have written guidelines and procedures for what they're doing to combat corrosion. And the last bullet is about how corrosion works. Basically, if you have a corrosive soil and you bury a pipe in it, there's a galvanic process that can be thought of in terms of a battery. That leads us to some corrosion control measures. We talked about coatings and wraps that isolate the metal from the soil. The galvanic process can be defeated by a cathodic protection, and I'm not going to go into any detail here, but generally what that means is you affix a sacrificial anode to the pipeline and let the soil eat the sacrificial anode away and preserve the pipeline. If you got internal corrosion, it's usually because of the contents you're carrying. It could be some biological activity depending on what the pipeline is. And there's a stress corrosion cracking that's a combination of tensile strength and corrosive medium being carried in the pipe. But corrosion is a very big issue, and it's a big science. It's studied a lot. You'll see a picture there in the left. I don't know if that's a split seam or a corrosion issue, but it's a big hole in that pipeline. All right, this is how you run a program to combat corrosion. You maintain, you inspect, and you prevent. And the prevention tools are injecting something into the system itself to combat internal corrosion, coating for the outside. Inhibitors can go inside or outside. And cathodic protection, we discussed about the sacrificial anodes. If you look in the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a guy introducing some strange-looking device into the pipeline. That's known as a pig. There are pigs for cleaning. There are smart pigs that photograph and make measurements. You can take laboratory samples of the fluids. This pig is a huge tool for diagnosing problems in your pipeline because it runs inside the pipeline. It's pressured up, and there's actually what's called a pig launching station and a pig receiving station. We had quite a discussion one time with a lady who understood that we were running animals through the pipeline, and she was very upset by that. But these are not animals. These are industrial tools. Okay, pumps and compressors. If you got a liquid, you're using a pump. If you got a gas, you're using a compressor. And that's a horrible oversimplification, but that's generally the way that goes. You've got to supply some energy to move the products a little further down the line or keep the pressure up and thereby keep moving down the line. Valves, this is an entire subject by itself. They can be operated a variety of different ways, manually, electric, pneumatic. It can be local operation. It can be remote operation. It can even be automatic operation. We'll cover that on the next slide, I think. It may take a good bit of time. If you look at this valve right here, let me pull the arrow over here. This valve wheel right here is the operator, the valve, mechanical valve operator, and the valve is actually buried deep underground here. And to operate this valve, someone comes and turns this wheel, and it changes the valve condition from open to close or close to open. And you know that somebody's got to get there first, and then they've got to operate the valve. So this is not a rapidly operating valve here.
Different types of valves, Jim, too. Check valves, block valves, pressure relief. There's a whole variety out there.
Good introduction, Bob.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. I should let you do this slide, I think. But
no, go ahead.
Block valve is not actually a type of valve. It's more a function. And there are ball valves, check valves, gate valves, flap valves, check valves. There's a very large number of valve types. And as I said, they can be remote or manual operation. Usually with a block valve, you're looking for something that is an auto-close valve due to a rapid change in pressure or some sensation of rapid change of volume, and by that I mean loss of volume. I'm going to give you an example here of a block valve. If you will, you have to use your imagination for this crude drawing, but you see the land surface here, and it's the river is here, and it's flowing out of the screen at you. And the liquid pipeline is drilled under the river and follows roughly the contours of the land. The block valves are placed at some safe location out of the floodplain on either side of the river. And so these block valves may be a considerable distance apart here, physically located a long ways apart. And if you have a leak here or a failure here, the first thing you know is that this product is likely to enter the river from this failure point. The second thing is that if the failure is here, the block valves auto-close. And then what happens is gravity will tend to drain the fluids out of this pipeline. Now, that's significant because in a 24-inch pipeline, I think there's around 16,500 gallons in a mile, and it's not unusual to have these block valves a mile or more apart. One more significant feature that is may affect you if you run into a situation like this is batched products. Now, batch products is the process and the practice of moving products sequentially through the same line in batches. And if you see the color diagram here, you see P1, P2, P3, P4. Those are batches that have interfaces, and they're separating, they're different grades of products that are run back-to-back down the line without any separating device, or may not be any separating device. And yes, at the boundary line between the batches, there is some mixing, and the pipeline people have learned how to manage that pretty well. It is possible to separate the batches with pigs, but you may very well have distillate 1 here, distillate 2 here, distillate 3, and distillate 4 moving down the same pipeline in the same time. Now, if this scenario that we just covered happened here, the significance of it is that you might start out by leaking gasoline into the river, but behind it might be a batch of diesel that drains out. And the importance of that is that, here's another example of the batches. I'm not going to belabor that, but you can see the mixed octane ratings. There's not much difference here between high-grade and medium-grade gasoline, but there's quite a difference between gasoline and diesel fuel. The significance of batching to EPA responders is that if you start leaking gasoline and you wind up leaking diesel fuel, the safety considerations may vary. You might have one set of practices both from safety and cleanup techniques for gasoline and a completely different one or a very different one for diesel fuel. The flash hazards of those two materials I would submit to you are pretty radically different. Okay. Manifolds are devices that control the flow paths of one pipeline and divide it into many or bring many into one. And the process is done to control flow and reroute it to different locations. This is the SCADA, the Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. And you see a guy sitting there in a kind of a Star Wars looking control room. They have various systems for leak detection and system pressure. There's even quantity checks so that they know that they shipped 5,000 barrels of material. Did they receive 5,000 barrels of material on the other end? There are career employees who work in some of these pipeline SCADA control rooms and never do anything else. They have redundant communication systems, satellite, radio, phone, et cetera, and they try to have a good system of fail-safe like block valves that doesn't always work, but they certainly do have them. Now, the takeaways for this module are call 811, know what's below, call before you dig. If you're a federal on-scene coordinator, the industry will tend to be responsive to you. They understand that you have the environmental interest at heart. And there's a tremendous amount of energy in the system, physical and chemical, and EPA employees should never be operating these systems, which should call on others to do so. Okay, Jean.
Well, thank you again for the participants. You guys can keep submitting your comments and questions as you have been doing into that Q&A window in the lower right corner. We did have one participant, and I think this question was probably geared more at the scenarios, but I'm going to read this one because it came in late. One of the participants wants to know what type of a response be if a significant amount of oil spilled from a ruptured pipeline is not detected for several days and then was discovered very close to a surface water body.
Well, our initial response would be we would be very upset. And we would immediately, I suspect, go into an information gathering mode, particularly given that for 24, 48 or more hours, this product has had the opportunity to be discharged onto the landscape. And as Jim just went through, it could be batch product. As he also noted, different products have different threats and risks. So, you know, we get the notification and we react. There might be a greater sense of urgency because it's late. There might be more harm, but at the same time, if it was gasoline, it was a hot day, that may have facilitated the nature of the response, because there frankly may have not been a lot we could have been able to do. On the other hand, if it was diesel and it got to a slow-moving water body, it could have made a real mess of things with respect to the shoreline cleanup and the like. Jim, Bob, would you like to add some more to that?
Yeah, a lot of times, too, we get notified, even if there is just a slight pipeline anomaly with no spill, there's a lot of investigation done, you know.
In Region 6, we used to get a lot of notifications that we thought were protective in nature, where someone would call and say, I saw a sheen in the river, or I saw oil in the river, and it came from upstream of my operation. The message to the EPA was, there's oil in the river, but it's not mine.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. We also did have one participant, Earl, you're not alone. We did have a participant who was able to comment that your comment on the license plate, it's BR549 from Heehaw. So you are not alone in your humor. Others are enjoying it as well.
I'm updating out, my BlackBerry.
You've been found out.
I do have some sort of general questions, but I think we might circle back to some of those near the end as we have time allotted. So let's go ahead and carry on with the presentation materials. But as far as the participants go, keep those questions and comments coming. We'll continue to take breaks in the remaining hour that we have.
All right. Well, Gene, thank you for keeping us well organized. And Jim, thank you for a readily understandable description and discussion of pipeline operations. All right. I will try to do as good in this module. And what this module is about is we're going to try to provide an overview of the environmental and human factors affecting cleanup decisions. As you can well imagine, if things were just left to the science, perhaps they would be easier, but they're not. Oftentimes, science is low issue on the totem pole. So some of the things we have to think about is what's being carried, as well as what are its properties and characteristics. For example, if you have a plume, as shown in this picture, your reaction is going to be quite a bit different than would be the case if there was just a spill to water. Okay, the factors, the broad categories are human and ecological. And some of the things you want to consider with respect to human is the threats to health. And part of that would include, what is the type of product that's released? Is it a crude or heavy fuel oil, which are persistent and have the potential to travel great distances, or are they refined products that are not as persistent, such as gasoline? The location and the quantity of release. Bob has mentioned this on several occasions. Is it a drop? Is it a cup? Is it a gallon? Is it something more? Where is it? Is as a result of its location, might it be a greater nuisance to people living along shorelines or elsewhere? Might there be cultural artifacts that could be at threat, either as a result of direct contact with the oil or as a result of cleanup operations? And that's something that in these days are at the forefront of EPA's consideration. Is how do we deal with our trustee relationship with respect to tribes and our requirement vis-a-vis the NCP, the National Contingency Plan, with respect to federal, state, and in some instances, international trustees? What is the media that's affected by the release? Is it open water? Is it an at-sea response or a shoreline? And by the way, this is a hard hat diver that you see here. Weather. There's going to be seasonal differences with use that may compel a more prompt response but in other instances may not, and that would influence perhaps the selection of your techniques. If it's the latter, maybe you can rely more on natural attenuation than would otherwise be the case of a more aggressive cleanup if the incident were to have occurred during the peak of the tourist season. Some additional human considerations to keep in mind include industry itself. One of the things, my experience in working with industry has always been, irrespective of whether it's pipelines or trucking or terminal, is that industry is always concerned about restricting access and prolonged closures. In other words, they want to get back to business as quickly as they can. Oftentimes, they're very concerned about management of response operations. For example, setting the command structure. If you have unified command set up, who do you allow on the end of the tent to be a part of unified command versus perhaps being a supporting or an assisting agency or falling down into lower levels of the command hierarchy into a particular section, branch, division, and the like? What is the speed with establishing command? Going back to the earlier comment, industry is moving quickly. If you've ever dealt with railroads, I'm sure you're familiar with how quickly they want to get the line back up, whereas EPA and others may be more slightly more focused on making sure that all of the stakeholders have been identified and appropriate roles have been called out and the like. What is the role of a responsible party in the management? Are they just a checkbook, or are they actually there assisting with decisions? The allocation of costs and resources, as well as, again, in unified command, as well as on the periphery, what are the various roles of federal, state, local, tribal governments, and the like? The organizational context and learning, what this refers to are those institutional pressures that will play themselves out with respect to government, regulators, customers, competitors, the community, interest groups, industry groups, and the like. And then the cost varies considerably on many variables, such as the type, the location of products spilled, where, characteristics of the affected area, and the like. Okay, the political constraints, you've got issues that are out there both with respect to the agency, and by that I mean EPA, or if we're in Idaho, the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality, if we're in Alaska, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Washington, the Department of Ecology. As you can well imagine, you've got all of these converging forces, all with different statutory and regulatory authorities, and you're trying to bring that all together under one big tent referred to as unified command. That does not mean that these various entities let go of everything, nor does that mean that there will always be a collaborative environment. Rather, there are often stressors, some of which we've gone over, which will put these players at odds. And we can remember perhaps, I believe it was on Yellowstone, when the governor of Montana went out and said, we will get every drop of oil, and so on and so forth. So, you know, that makes agencies, it puts them in a difficult position. Legal constraints. You have the statutory and regulatory frameworks. We've discussed that. There might be the influence of existing agreements, such as memorandum of agreements, memorandum of understandings. Two in particular that we oftentimes deal with is there's such a memorandum with the Fish and Wildlife Service for Section 7 consultation on an emergency basis for threatened and endangered species or critical habitat. There's also one for the National Historic Preservation Act that lays out certain steps that OSCs and others must go through so as to otherwise avoid that procedural process that they would have to deal with. Multi-agency jurisdiction, depending upon the size of the incident, you might have, let's say it's along the Columbia River or some other large tributary where you could have the states of Oregon and Washington and Idaho involved. You could have tribes from Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. You could have counties. You could have the Army Corps of Engineers who have responsibility for the dams. You get the picture. Public opinion, things that we oftentimes struggle with are perceptions of control, the appropriate roles of the responsible party, the role of state and local tribal governments, who oftentimes are viewed as being more susceptible to local influence as opposed to taking a larger national perspective, and very importantly, how clean is clean, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And then you have the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, and what they may push for and bring to the table of expertise. There's also socioeconomic considerations. For example, we've talked about where and what, if it happens in an area of high regional, national, or importance, international importance, the response may be different than if it were just local or not, something people don't really care about per se. There's also seasonal differences. And for example, there may be spawning that would occur. There might be migratory pass-throughs of eagles or swans or geese, something of that could exacerbate the problem. The aesthetic appeal, is there an appeal in an amenity use of shorelines and beaches? Might it be near a park or a boat launch or something like that? Social media, is there one versus many spokespersons? Are communicative techniques transferable across different mediums? What about transparency? How do the agencies have to react to this almost never-ending demand for immediate information, whether it be properly vetted or not? And then four, you've got the effects on tourism and marina and the like, for example. There might be substitute incomes, such as wages and whatnot, and secondary impacts, such as the local procurement of needed services and whatnot, but will that replace what's otherwise lost? And then there's also legacy concerns that might be out there from the human health perspective, or just the human category in terms of older pumps and systems and pipelines that were put in place long before EPA and other agencies came into play. There may be other concern, and because of that, you might have to deal with PCBs and insulating materials that you might otherwise have not had to worry about. There may be oily pits that were once used for the discharge of waste oil. There might be mercury-filled instruments and whatnot. All of those type of legacy concerns could come into play unless they're properly considered. And Jim, I think I stole your thunder on that. Would you like to add anything more?
Keep moving.
All right, sir. Ecological. So we've gone to humans, so let's talk about the bugs and bunnies a little bit. Again, type of product will influence its effect on the environment and the response, as well the location and the quantity, the geology. You want to consider the type of shoreline that you have. What are the prevailing winds? What are the currents? So on and so forth.
Yeah, one interesting point here, Earl, is trying to determine endpoints in a cleanup. It's pretty easy.
We're getting there. So yeah. Save your thunder, man.
All right.
Okay, other ecological, the type and sensitivity of communities. You want to look at the physical properties of the spilled oil, sheens, sludges, emulsions, what are the soluble fractions, all of which could prevent respiration, photosynthesis, or feeding. You need to be concerned about the food chain as well and how the uptake or the exposure to product could then be transferred into larger organisms up the food chain and so on and so forth. as I mentioned earlier, keep in mind the type of species present. If you have salmon, perhaps they're spawning at that time. Or if you have an end-of-life cycle, such as with kokanee, that are dying, and you're in a migratory pathway where eagles come by and feed on the dying kokanee. Incidental to feeding on the kokanee, the birds may become exposed, and it could have a damning effect on their health and well-being. You've also got other benthic organisms, mollusks and whatnot, that could be susceptible to taking this up through the food chain and the like. Okay, that's very quick, but Gene, are there any questions out there before we move into the next module, which is GEMS?
Well, why don't we go ahead and take one question, which is asking, what exactly is a good percentage recovery of spilled oil?
You know, that is an excellent question, and frankly, it depends. So, for example, if you're in a fast water scenario where you've got a very narrow canyon, you've got the road blasted out right next to the river, and it's an upland spill. In other words, it goes to the upgradient ditch and only gradually works its way down the road prism. In that scenario, you might lose maybe, let's just say, 50% of the product to the river. Well, as a practical matter, by the time you get there and you start to employ the different types of techniques, you might recover only 1, 3, 4, or 5% of the product. So it depends upon the site-specific conditions, to include the stream flow. In a slower moving stream, you might be able to recover a greater amount of product because you don't have those physical influences such as evaporation, dispersion, dissolution, and the like of the product. And if you're on a lake, you may recover an even greater amount of product. You might get 75%. So it varies largely with the site-specific conditions. How quickly can you get out there to start to try to recover it and the like? Time of the year, all of those variables come into play. Jim, Bob, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, the bottom line is it's hard to answer because it's highly, highly variable. I know here in Alaska we get rivers that run as much as 9 knots, and given the season and safety issues, I mean, you could have an incident with a spill and you might not get any.
I think the key point in this, at least for me, is that the percentage that you recover is never going to be 100, and it's probably pretty important for you to set the expectations up front that you're not going to get it all back. People who are unfamiliar with spilled oil tend to think that we'll clean it all up. Well, at the end of the day, when there's an oil spill, there's a bathtub ring. Now, how much of a bathtub ring is left and how serious it is dependent upon the endpoints you set. We'll talk some more about that later, but it's very clear that you're not going to get 100% of it back, and you should not try to lead people to believe that.
Yeah, and one other point, and up in North Idaho, for example, where you've got these fast-moving rivers, it may take people 6 or 8 hours to get to the spill site. Let's say it's related to a trucking incident or even a pipeline incident. We've got pipelines all over up here. Oftentimes, you don't even think in terms of recovery because you know to the extent that anything that's gone in the water is not recoverable. So what that will do is influence what you do try to do, such as protect downstream water intakes and things of that nature. So, yeah, it's an all but impossible thing to answer.
Good question, though.
Okay, let's just take one more question. And this next participant would just commented that the mercury issue reminds them of a past seminar involving mercury contamination from mining. And they want to know if EPA still collects free mercury for disposal.
Good question. We try not to, no. You know, many, many years ago, when first responders lacked the capacity to deal with mercury, irrespective of whether it's a thermometer's worth of mercury or, you know, a pint of mercury incidental to trying to recover gold and whatnot, EPA would respond. But over the ensuing years, we've spent considerable effort and money to build the capacity of first responders, be it fire, regional response teams, and the like. And so for those types of incidents where there's a mercury release, do we respond? No, we try not to. But if incidental to our involvement with other things, so for example, you've got these legacy issues. If we had a spill and we came upon some sort of a device that had mercury, yes, we would deal with it. But we try to push stuff like that down to the local level.
A lot of states out there have hazardous waste collection, pickup type programs where you can bring in household quantities. I think that's about it.
Yeah, household drop-offs.
Yeah, and most of the time in a pipeline scenario, this would be at a mercury would be found at a metering or a pumping or a compressor station. And in almost every instance that I'm aware of, we've had a number of these actually occur where the pipeline company was the responsible party and they undertook a responsible party lead cleanup and they wanted EPA to sanction what they were doing. So it can happen in the pipeline scenario.
Okay, let's go ahead and resume with the technical presentation. Again, it's 418 and we're on slide number 130.
All right, we're going to move smartly through this pipeline incident, and I think what you're going to find is that incident is a term of art that, to harken back to an earlier discussion, is really defined by Department of Transportation. This sign on this pipeline says, please don't climb on the pipeline. And what is the DOT definition of an incident? Well, it's a fatal injury or a major injury. I don't know exactly what major is, but evacuation of more than two dozen people, a closure of a major transportation artery, and that could be rail, highway, or an airport, and alteration of a flight plan or flight operation. There's a few more things that go under the definition of incident. Release of radioactive materials from packaging, and that could be shielding is another way to say that. We'll have a slide talking about where the heck radioactive materials come from in the pipeline business in just a bit. And they have a threshold quantity of 11.9 gallons or 88.2 pounds of a severe marine pollutant, which has its own definition. And if you multiply those numbers by 10, you come up with a bulk quantity of a hazardous material. So those are the things that are parts of an incident definition. Let's go to the next slide. This is a hazardous material. Now, I want to be sure you don't mix this up with a hazardous substance or a hazardous waste. This is a hazardous material as defined by DOT. It's a material capable of posing an unreasonable risk to health, safety, or property when transported in commerce. I would submit to you that covers a lot of territory. Now, if DOT wants to talk about a hazardous substance, they are, in fact, using the CERCLA definition that you're familiar with. If they talk about a hazardous waste, they are, in fact, using a definition that you're also familiar with. It's anything subject to the EPA manifesting requirements for transportation. So make sure you get those definitions right. They're often very important. Okay, so what about incidents relative to pipelines in general? Well, the first thing you can say about pipelines is they're very safe. In fact, they are the safest mode of transport. If you use some figure like gallons per mile, gallons safely transported per mile, or some other quantity per distance, this is absolutely the safest mode of transport. It's underground. It's out of contact with the public. It's very efficient. It's low cost per unit volume once the pipeline's installed, and it will move a lot of volume in a hurry. Has a very low accident rate, so pipelines are recognized widely as being a real good thing. It's a real good way to move a lot of material around the country. I think this one almost goes without saying. This is a DOT speak, but it's pretty common sense. Release of product carried by these pipelines can impact surrounding populations, property, and the environment, may result in injuries or fatalities, as well as property damage, property and environmental damage. This is the Enbridge pipeline in the picture that occurred in August of 2010, and there's still some cleanup work going on there, and I would suggest to you that's 3 years later, so that may influence you a little bit about what you choose carefully as an endpoint for the cleanup. But we're going to explore a little bit about what causes pipelines to fail. These are the major causes right here. Material or well failures, corrosion, excavation problems, bad operation, outside forces, and other causes. We're going to define those a little bit, but let's look at the way these are divided up and proportioned here. About a third of them, pipeline incidents, are due to weld failure. Let me back up just. These are 2011 stats, or based on 2011 statistics for liquid pipelines, this pie chart is. And there is some variation from year to year, and there's also some slight variation between natural gas and petroleum pipelines. But the trends are pretty close, and they're pretty well illustrated. So, again, about a third of the pipeline failures or incidents are due to material or well failures. If you look up in the right side, corrosion is the next big slice of the pie, and it's about a quarter of all the problems. And if you add those two together, you're already over 60% right there. So that's a pretty good slice of the pie. The next, in terms of frequency, is excavation problems, and that's one in six, roughly. Incorrect operation is about one in ten or thereabout. And those are about the same percentages for all other causes and the outside forces. And we'll look at these in a little more detail as we go through the next slides. This is the weld or the material failure. Welding is obviously the steel pipe joining technique, and there is a huge number of welds in pipelines as you crisscross the country with them. Every joint is welded to the next joint. The welds are carefully considered. There was an electric resistance welding technique that was abandoned in 1970 as a result of inspections of the welds, of fresh welds, and subsequent failures of welds. But what they determined was that this technique was not satisfactory for joining these joints of pipes together. It caused too many problems. All right. This is an X-ray inspection a picture, and as the caption indicates, the source material is in that pig or camera, as with the red, it's here. Let me move my arrow. This is the camera, and they roll this camera on a track through the inside of the pipe, and at the joints they pull the radioactive source out of the pig, and the radiation shines through the pipe, and the exterior of the pipe is wrapped in film, and they're actually able to inspect the joint by looking at the film carefully. And yes, if they have bad welds, they grind them out and weld them back. Do it again. Pipeline welders are some of the finest welders in the world. They're certified. All right, corrosion is a big problem and a big deal. It's, remember from pie chart, this is your second biggest cause. And there are several ways to protect it. Protective coatings we've talked about before. There are usually some sort of coating, often bitumastic, which is a tar-like material, to isolate the metal from a corrosive soil it's buried in. You can put something inside the pipe to inhibit. You can put a sacrificial anode on the outside, and remember the sacrificial anode disappears and the pipe stays in place. That's taking advantage of the electrolytic nature of corrosion. Inspection and monitoring is a huge deal. Again, you see the pig in the lower right corner of the photograph there. These pigs are tremendously sophisticated, and they make a lot of racket when they move through the pipe. They push them through with product behind them and in front of them. All right, excavation. This is about one in six of all the pipeline incidents and failures. It can be caused by pipeline workers or somebody that's not in the pipeline. Gas distribution pipelines are almost like a favorite target of people excavating. Many homeowners will rupture their own gas line, service line coming from the neighborhood main, and it's usually a small line. It can be done by things as simple as digging a post hole for installing a wooden privacy fence. These kinds of excavation problems are largely preventable. If you would call the 811, know what's below. They come out and mark the line, and if they mismark it, then you're not liable. If you dig and don't call, you probably are going to be liable, so it's a big deal. Incorrect operations, this is about only about 10%, so we're down now into the minor causes. this is accidental actions or the wrong valve open, overfilling or overpressuring something, and mismarking a pipeline prior to excavation work. Sometimes there are training problems. The operators are not following the right procedures, maybe not using the right equipment or the right techniques for repair, or they have assessed a situation to be one thing when it turns out to be quite another. And those are causes of incorrect operation. Outside force is kind of interesting. It's the one of the other minor causes, also about 10%. Earth movement, this could be earthquakes, it could be landslides, it could be shrink swell characteristics of expansive soils. Weather is another problem that can cause an outside force or is characterized as an outside force. Fire explosion due to something outside the pipeline, being struck by a vehicle, and vandalism. Those are all considered outside causes. And I guess that brings us back to the question slide. Gene, do you have any questions submitted?
Yes, we did have a question come in from one participant that would like to know if earthquakes are factored into the design and installation of national and transcontinental pipelines.
My understanding is yes. I'm not the expert, but my understanding is yes.
Yes, it's certainly for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. There's definitely design built into that. I mean, it's placed in a zigzag pattern in certain areas where it's more susceptible. I think a design rating is anywhere from 5.5 to 8.5 on the Richter scale. And there's also monitoring sensors out there that I only can speak for Alaska.
Okay.
I know there are design considerations in some of the fault zones around the New Madrid Fault and the one in California. What's the fault there? San Andreas?
We also would like to know if you could discuss a little bit about pipeline maintenance from the inside regarding gunk buildup.
Well, I can't discuss much of it because I don't know too much about it, but I've seen what comes out at a pig receiver station sometimes. One of the less sophisticated use of a pig is a pipeline pig is to force a device that works largely like a toothbrush. It's got stiff wire bristles on it instead of the nice soft nylon bristles you would use on your toothbrush, but it has the same effect. It scrubs the interior surfaces of the pipeline as it goes through there, and they often will put hay bales up at the receiver point, and they move the pig into an area where they can valve it off and successfully contain the flow of the pipeline around that pig receiver station, and then they open the pig receiver station up, and they take out the pig, and they take out a lot of gunk, as you described it. It's pretty astounding stuff what will stick to the inside of a pipeline. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
I think so. Why don't we go ahead and continue on with the presentation? Again, we've got about 30 minutes left in our time today.
All right. Well, thank you, Jean. Okay, we're going to spend this module going over pipeline emergency response operations. And the intent is just to give you a familiarity as to what some of the issues are that you could expect to encounter and the structure of the command system. Oftentimes, this is what the initial response looks like. You have a lot of people looking in one direction, wondering what in the hell is going on. What's the next step? Okay, and in order to deal with that, we have what's referred to as the National Incident Management System. And this system gives us the Incident Command Structure, or the ICS organization. And what's unique about this is that the concept provides both for flexibility, so that you can take a structure that we're all trained in and respond and overlay it on any type of an incident, and it's scalable. It can fit any size of incident. So, for example, many of us are trained as an operations sections chief. That's not unique to a oil spill incident or a CERCLA incident or a Stafford Act incident. Rather, we're trained in the concepts of the position and what the roles and responsibilities are. And as such, we can be deployed to any type of an incident. And in most instances today, that's what you're going to find is people who have been trained to fill out one of those command or general staff positions. And it goes a long ways towards getting things happening in a very prompt manner. Now, generally, what you'll see is a structure that's comprised of the blue boxes. And then beneath these boxes, you'll have branches, division group supervisors, single resources, strike teams, task forces, and the like. But what we're finding more and more common today, particularly when you're working with RPs, is that you find a legal officer that's part of the command staff or that is attached to a deputy incident commander, and or you find a business interruption chief. And this person's role is to identify, contact, and consult with all internal and external groups that are financially impacted in some manner as a result of the incident. And up at the Pump Station 1 incident, one of the things I vividly recall is that the RP had an attorney present at all meetings, just about all meetings that were held. Well, fortunately, we didn't staff up in response to that, nor did the state, but, you know, it just puts a cloud over things, if you will. And then, of course, you know, the business interruption chief, as Bob mentioned, you know, the impacts of having the tap shut down are far-reaching. They go both with respect to the country as a whole, but to the revenues of the state as well. And so that could take on a very important role. Now, generally, what you encounter with a response is the development of an incident action plan. So other than the first group of people who are responding in the emergency phase, simultaneous with that or by another complement of people, you're going to start to put together an incident action plan, and that's your plan for the next operational period, which might be 12 hours in length, it might be 24 hours, it could be 72, it could be 96, who knows. But you're going to develop that plan, and this is what's going to be used to staff the response, to get the needed resources into the response and the like. And with respect to a pipeline, these are some of the issues that you can expect to see, some of which you might not always see, but for an oil or a pipeline type response, size and type of the pipeline, what are the products involved that are being transported, are they crude, natural gas, refined? What is the nature of the incident? Is it a release with no fire? Is it a release with fire? Is there a vapors cloud and the like? And the exposures, what type of exposures in proximity to the incident are there? Is it an urban, suburban, rural area? And recall that where it happens could influence the nature of the response, as we discussed earlier. The environmental conditions you would want to keep in mind, particularly with respect to wind direction if there's a fire, safety considerations unique to the incident, the isolation of the pipeline. Part of what Jim said and one of the features that makes pipeline responses unique is how can it be isolated? What is the distance between isolation points? What are backflow considerations to the breach and the like. What are the implications for the incident becoming greater than what it might have otherwise been? How could it escalate from perhaps a liquid release to a release that is now complicated by the ignition of flammable vapors and gases and whatnot. What are the infrastructure impacts? Recall Jim's discussion of the lattice, if you will, as to how things may be laid out and how there could be an effect going upstream or downstream depending upon the product and the nature of the pipeline configuration. And then some of the common strategic goals that you're going to run into. First of all, the NCP gives you three, one of which is the safety is utmost. You want everyone to go home with everything they came to the incident with. You've got spill control. You've got leak control. You've got fire control, which could be unique. And you've got recovery as well, all of which could be unique for a pipeline incident. And these are just some of the common strategic goals, again, to complement the others. Keep stakeholders informed, maximize protection, recover and rehabilitate injured wildlife. Minimize adverse economic impacts, both with respect to the industry, but to the community as a whole. We can all recall the nightly news during the Gulf incident and the impact that is still being felt by communities. And then most importantly, the impact to cultural and historic resources. Okay, let's talk about endpoints for a moment, which Bob introduced. This is one of the most important things, one of the most important first issues that you should consider when responding to an incident. And when you think about it, trying to figure out how clean is clean, if you will, is going to influence operation both with respect to the type of resources that are needed by the operations section, but also the types of techniques that will be deployed, and also what the expectations are of not only your agency, but the public with respect to the cleanup efforts, and when do they end, which is something you should also be considering when you pull up on scene, is the development of your exit strategy. How are you going to get out of there? And so cleanups can be, endpoints can be qualitative, or they can be quantitative. An example of a qualitative endpoint is that you can't see anything anymore, or that the nature of the cleanup would be more harmful than would otherwise be the case were you to go just let it be. Cleanup measures would be excessively costly in view of their contribution to the cleanup. An example of that we have up in North Idaho, where again you have a spill along a wild and scenic river. Spill went into the ditch. It just happened to be on the upstream ditch, the upslope ditch. It just happened to be on a segment of roadway that was heavily blasted so as to construct the roadway. You had about 600 or 700 gallons of gasoline that was discharged, the vast majority of which is confined in those fractures in the rocks, and there's only a release maybe 2 or 3 days within any given year when you've got surface water and groundwater flows such. There are those interests that said millions of dollars should have been spent to dig up that roadway so as to remove product that was questionable as to whether or not you could even do it. Fortunately, in that particular instance, we said no because at the point of compliance in the river, there was no appreciable measurements of the constituents of concern. So the point is as loosey-goosey as that may sound and as adverse as we are to costs are an ever-present part of the landscape these days. Quantitative endpoints include such things as surface water quality criteria, not exceed background or not exceed some promulgated regulation or the like. Okay, so Some of the issues that affect the selection of endpoints include the type of product and the amount of product spilled. What is the type of shoreline? What is the value of the habitat or use of that segment of affected shoreline or riverbank? What are the technical and operational considerations for cleanup activities? Are you, for example, transitioning between fall and winter? Might it, the release have traversed down a very, very steep bank? What is the anticipated rate of natural attenuation? Gasoline versus diesel versus crude. What are the influences of weather? And most importantly, what are the perceptions of risk? All of these issues affecting endpoints may require compromise due to the wide range of factors that come into play from all of the different interests. Okay, some practical considerations for achieving cleanup. How much, what type and how much can you get? What are the environmental sensitivities? Consultation, you know, to what extent have you reached out to your other federal and state and tribal and local stakeholders, given them a sense of participating in the process, all the while recognizing that sometimes the best you can hope for is to agree to disagree. And again, the widely varying cleanup standards or demands. You will have demands on one end of the spectrum that says, get everything out of there, and you'll have demands that will say, let natural attenuation run its course because it's cost prohibitive to do otherwise. Okay, some additional considerations to think of. Long-term deployment of absorbent booms. If the spill happens in the late fall, you're right on the cusp of transitioning into the winter months. Any absorbent material placed on low flow conditions are not going to last through the high flow conditions and vice versa. Not everything can be recovered. We touched upon this earlier. And that means from water as well as land. Weather and natural attenuation, which we'll just touch upon briefly when we start to go over the suite of potential response techniques that are available for use. Okay, what happens when you realize that you can't get it all? And as we have said, in almost all instances, you're not going to be able to get it all. So what do you have to start to consider once you've come to grips with that? What are the technical and operational issues that are out there with respect to the investigation and cleanup? In other words, if you can't get it all, do you have to go into some sort of a long-term surface water monitoring program? Do you have to come back and periodically visit the site to make observations, so on and so forth? What is the balance between costs and spending millions of dollars and digging up a road for but a couple of hundred gallons of gasoline? Are there other entities that you can sort of hand off responsibility for sort of the day-to-day operations of the cleanup? Not that EPA is delegating its NCP authorities, which we cannot do, but rather there may be a state agency that is capable of overseeing that the cleanup effort on a long-term basis beyond what EPA is otherwise available to do. And then what is the anticipated rate of attenuation that might happen? Some other considerations are, what are the institutional constraints and pressures? Do you have a situation where you've got the state and EPA in agreement, but on the other side of the spectrum, you have a tribal entity or an NGO, a non-governmental interest organization, who's not happy? And do you have congressional involvement, legislative involvement? All of those types of pressures can come to bear on what you do. Is the residual product, you know, what is the real harm that it can be expected, and how might you quantify that? What is the use? Is it down at, you know, 40 feet down at the base of a steep embankment where there's no opportunity for pull off to walk down, but there might be the opportunity from an aesthetics perspective of rafters or tubers or something to see it from the beach. And what is the impact to the economic resources? So, for example, if we were to have closed off a particular segment of road so as to chase the product, that would have forced people who otherwise use that roadway as a means of commerce to go to other routes, which might add considerably to their overall costs. You have to think about that. And then we had the TAPS, the Alaska system, where so much of the country's product flows through those, and if you shut that down, what are not only the local, regional, national, but the international impacts that have got to be taken into consideration? Okay, a couple of other things to think about is just how this might evolve the response over any given operational perspective. And I suspect you can well imagine is that when things first happen, you're on the offense. And that gradually will evolve into a defensive mode as you've got your feet on the ground. And then the non-intervention mode is the more long-term approach to things. So just, you know, you've got a whole different feeling that will play depending upon which one of these are. And then these are just some of the safety considerations unique to pipelines that we've discussed, that Jim has ran through. You've got all types of hazards associated with the products, and because of batching, you may have multiple hazards. Okay, are there any questions, or should I just, since we're running short of time, I'd like to propose that I just keep on going, if that's okay, Gene, Jim?
That works for me. Keep going.
Jim, are you on board?
Yep.
All right, sir. Thank you. Okay, oil spill response technique. The intent of this module is just to give you a sense as to what is out there. Okay, when you select the options, these are the types of variables that you want to keep in mind. It's all common sense. I sense you're sensing a theme here. Okay, first of all, while you may not think about it, their soil may be impacted. We've given you a couple of scenarios where soil as a secondary source may ultimately give you the nexus with surface water, or just in your attempt to recover product to mitigate its impact, you may turn to soil cleanups. You've got both in situ and ex situ, and I suspect many of you are familiar with these, but these are some of the things that are available. You also have groundwater that you may have to consider. And again, you've got in situ, ex situ, bioremediation, air sparging, pump and treat, and the like. And then you get into surface water, which is where perhaps most of your time will be spent. And there's a broad suite. We mentioned natural attenuation and monitoring. It may be the case that that's the best thing that you can do so as to avoid harm to the resource that would be disproportionate to any gain that would otherwise be realized were you to go in there and aggressively attempt to remove the product. Aside from that, you've got various techniques that you can employ. You've got barriers that could be placed in your attempt to protect features from the impact of the discharge. This could just as easily be a surface water intake. You've got berms that could be placed so as to protect the resource. Here's the shoreline. Here you might be looking at protecting critical habitat. Yeah, you have booms, which is very common. There's different types of booms. It appears that both of these are what I would refer to as curtain booms, which is to say beneath the surface, you have a curtain that might extend 6, 12, 18, 24 inches. The idea is that that curtain would prevent underflow from happening due to wave action or wind, and oftentimes you see absorbance. Such as this sausage boom here that's placed as part of the booms to help to absorb material that would flow into and be captured and retained by the boom. You have skimmers, which work very well. After you've placed your booms, let's say your containment or your diversion booms, in such a manner as to collect material, you could then come in with skimmers so as to remove the product. This one is what's referred to as a drum skimmer. They just run and run and run, and they're oleophilic skimmers, and so the oil attaches and then rotates into there, and it can capture and be removed. Here you can see where you've got absorbent materials that is not only catching the oil but holding back the oil, and you've got the drum skimmer coming in there and doing its thing. Physical herding is just using a fire hose to get large quantities of material corralled so that they can be removed by other techniques. You might have a vac truck up here on the bank that's sucking this stuff up, or there might be other absorbent materials that could be there and used in conjunction with pushing the product into a more manageable location. There's manual oil removal, people out on the beach picking stuff up. There's mechanical, where you can use equipment to run up and down the beaches and pick stuff up. The sorbents that I mentioned, the sausage boom pads, you can also use it to wipe surfaces with. And there's like these, there's a wide variety of different materials that are out there and configurations. Vacuum, I mentioned a vac truck that could be used. Here you see two techniques. Wouldn't want to be this poor fella. I guess that would be okay on my back. Debris removal, always got to keep in mind, it's just not the oil. You're going to have debris, garbage that is soaked in oil. You're going to have vegetation and other things that you're going to want to remove. May be able to be disposed of, but may be able may also require decontamination if there's any attempt to return material to the original owner and the like. Flooding is another example where you could use water to push material through other material to a point where it can then be collected, such as what you see here. Incidental to flooding, you have flushing, very similar to herding, but here you could use high pressure, low pressure, you could use hot water, cold water, and the like. What you see here is all of the techniques are oftentimes used in conjunction with other techniques. And also notice the different safety issues that come into play here, which you have to keep in mind as well. Alternative countermeasures that are out there include chemical dispersants, biological agents, and in situ burning. All of these have their advantages and disadvantages. Suffice to say, typically if any types of these measures are employed, you have to rise above the incident itself and go into regional response teams and seek approval at a higher level and from other agencies that might be involved. And then in addition to the oil, recovery of the oil, wildlife always takes on an interesting dimension of here. You know, one of the things you want to keep in mind is keep the oil away from the resource, keep the resource away from the oil, such as loud noises and so on and so forth, and capture and treat oiled wildlife. All right, Gene, should I keep on going? I've got probably just a...
Yep, keep going.
Two more minutes here. Okay, disposal of oil and oily debris. This is what you could end up with at the end of the day. Some of the things to keep in mind from shoreline cleanup, you've got oil debris, oiled materials, whether it be natural or man-made. You've got protective equipment, disposal equipment from recovery operations. You've got, again, equipment, personnel. You've got oil and oily water, which could be incidental to the use of vac trucks, material, PPE, and the like. And then you've got from the equipment itself, all of what you see here has got to be decontaminated at some point. And it may need to be decontaminated before you move, you know, from one segment to the other. It might be 100 feet, or it may be at the end of the day or at the end of the job. Who knows? As far as the disposition of the materials go, to the extent practical, you should try to segregate your streams in as much as you can. Oil from water, maybe you can recycle the oil, maybe not. If you can't recycle it, then you've got to go to a properly permitted disposal facility. There might be other things. The wildlife carcasses could introduce a whole new dimension of biohazards that perhaps you had not thought of. And this is both with respect to what you can see as well as what you can't see that you might have to chase in holes and bins and the like. And all of this material has got to be handled in accordance with the relevant statutes, which in some instances might now take this material that is otherwise non-hazardous and suddenly it becomes hazardous because the product has been commingled with other hazardous materials that are only present as a result of the discharge, be it related to fire or flood incidental to the discharge and the like. And so this could create it's the whole new set of issues that you would need to keep in mind. And so, Gene, that's it. I'm going to go quickly to the summary statement. Yeah?
Yay!
And would like to say that the purpose of this course is only to provide an overview. There is no way humanly possible that we could begin to address the full spectrum of issues that come into play, much less to address those issues in substantive ways. So we've sort of given you that 70,000 foot view of things. We hope you find it helpful. And we look forward to whatever comments that you might have in the hopes that we ourselves can learn by them, but more importantly, be challenged by them to make this an even better presentation if and when it should be offered again. And I'd like to say, Jim or Bob, do you have any closing comments that you would like to make?
Good job. Thank you.
Yes, good job for sure.
All right, Gene. Any questions you want to go through quickly?
Let's try to take just one extra minute here, and let me get a comment that just came in regarding pigging. And one of our participants commented that the pigging gunk tends to be paraffin-based materials that's recycled. And they also gave us a little bit of a history gem that pigs really were stillborn or other small pigs that were used to push blockages through the pipelines up until the 1920s, and that's
correct,
where the term comes from.
Yeah, that's great. That's correct.
Well, we've spent, I can't tell you how many evenings trying to figure out where the word pig came from. And as I recall, Bob, it had something to do with the noise. But this is the first time I've heard dead pigs.
Yeah, it's the first time I've heard it, too.
Yep.
So, hey, Bill, thank you, man.
And then the only other question that I want to pull up here is that we did have a participant comment about natural attenuation. And they went on to say that it's a really slow process and could take years. If the soil condition and presence of microbes, which play a role, and they're important in the breakdown of the spilled product, so they want to know what you guys think about that in reference to dealing with these pipeline spills.
Let me take a shot at that one. The residual in the soil through natural attenuation is slow. And certainly you're right, soil organisms are important, but generally they're present in the soils. And you can stimulate the activity of the microbes using traditional agricultural fertilizers and tilling, and that greatly accelerates the decomposition of all the organic materials. In fact, it's a huge rate increase. So you might try that and work with your state folks to work that out.
And well said, Jim. And also, it's a practical matter. There's always going to be some residual component. And so natural attenuation and to me, largely represents, a chain in that overall cleanup or rather a link in that overall cleanup chain. There's always going to be a role for it.
Okay, great. Well, with that, let me go ahead and go through some final closing reminders for everyone today. If you joined us today and are looking to get credits or a certificate for participating, I'm just going to jump through this. First of all, you can find a copy of the presentation materials on the seminar homepage as well as on the resources page. Those URLs are available under the related URLs. If you're listening to the recording, those links are still active. You too can download the slides as well as follow the links to the feedback form. If you fill out that feedback form, there is a box you can check to have an email sent to you, at least confirming that you filled out the form after the live delivery. Again, same thing goes for the people watching the recorded version. Usually you can earn credit for CEUs or PDHs with your accrediting institution if you take the registration email, the seminar slides, and that confirmation email. For this particular seminar series, though, we are going to generate electronic certificates. So if you do require an actual training certificate, make sure you fill out that feedback form and then send an email to Austin from Tetra Tech, and she will actually email you an electronic training certificate for today's session. I just wanted to thank everybody. We did have about 80 individuals join us from all over the world today for today's seminar. And again, we are going to continue on with the CEC training for OSCs throughout November as well as into December. So I want to thank our three instructors who joined us today and made this a lively session with some interactive polls. And I want to thank all of those participants who joined us around the country. The recording will be made available from today's live broadcast in just a few days. You will automatically get an email from me when that recording is available. If you have any other outstanding questions for our instructor, you can find their contact information on that seminar homepage. And again, please feel free to share your thoughts with us